Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Nothing tastes as good as healthy feels, basically.
Sir, how does Canada rank in this report?
We compared Canadian physical activity levels of our children to 48 other countries, and what we found was that this is a global issue, that all countries across the globe are struggling with getting children and youth more physically active. Kids are just too sedentary, not active enough for their healthy growth and development. And Canada overall score of physical activity was a D.
How does Canada rank so low? What are the factors?
There's 10 different indicators that we looked at across the 49 countries, and what we found was that Canada's actually not doing too bad when it comes to infrastructure and structured sport and physical activity programs. However, our kids are still not active enough, and they spend too much time in front of screens, and they have very low levels of physical fitness. In Canada, only 35% of kids meet the physical activity guidelines. So what we wanted to do is wanted to learn from others. So those countries across the globe that are doing well, what are they doing differently than Canada? And where can we focus our energies? And so we've found, you know, two countries in particular, Slovenia and Japan, are doing fairly well with respect to physical activity in kids. But they approach it very differently. Slovenia, for instance, they focus on the school system. So every child in Slovenia has 70 minutes of physical activity every single day. In addition to that, they've implemented a national standardized fitness testing for every student, and they're experiencing over 80% of their kids meeting physical activity guidelines. Japan takes a totally different approach. They focus on active transportation to school. So the way they build and design their communities is such that schools are no more than 4 kilometers from where kids live, and so kids must take active forms of transportation to school, whether that's walking or cycling or wheeling, and they're in the top 10% of fitness levels across the globe. So what we know is that this is an issue that is experienced by all countries. Canada does well in certain areas, but we have lots to learn from other countries and in other areas as well.
Well, given our culture and our climate, what do you think are the things that we could be doing better?
Well, you know, certainly modern lifestyles and increases in screen time and the urbanization of our communities has really engineered physical activity out of our daily lives. And what we found is that in Canada anyway, kids are spending more and more time on screens, not only for recreational purposes, but for as a mechanism and as a mode of communicating with one another. And so that's impacting their levels of physical activity. So we need to, you know, instead of focusing on building our communities and built engineering, we need to social engineer physical activity back into our Canadian culture. We need to ensure that it's part of our social climate and that it's a priority and that we're working collectively to address it. You know, when we look at countries like Netherlands, for instance, cycling is just part of their cultural fabric. It's not only a way of transportation, but it's a means of physical activity. In Canada, we need to look at putting physical activity back into our cultural social norms and to ensure that it's a priority, whether it's in schools, community, or in the home.
So practically, how do you do that?
Well, we need to keep talking about it, and we need to keep encouraging policymakers and leaders to make this a priority. Certainly, schools have a very important role to play. You know, we need to ensure that there are policies, just like in Slovenia, where kids have physical activity on a daily basis. But we need to ensure that those policies are consistently implemented. You know, we have a number of jurisdictions that have good policies, but they're not being enforced and they're not being implemented. We need to look at active school travel plans for school boards. We need to encourage kids. In Canada, only 20% of our kids take active forms of transportation to school, 20%. We need to increase that. You know, as in the home, as parents, we need to ensure that physical activity is valued as part of a family unit. We need to monitor and reduce the screen time of our kids. We also need to avoid becoming hyper-parenting, and this has been a trend in Canada over the years, where we're trying to protect our kids so we keep them indoors. We need to ensure that kids have the opportunity in a safe environment to go outside, explore nature, and play with their friends. And we need to stop overstructuring our kids and allowing them to have more freedom and more free play.
How important is this matter?
It's significant. It's a public health crisis, actually. And, you know, if we don't address it, we'll have, you know, a generation of couch potatoes that will have adverse effects on their physical, mental, and social and cognitive health problems. Physical activity contributes to many aspects of one's life, and so we need to ensure that our kids are getting enough every day.
Thank you so much for this.
Thank you.
The stars at night are big and bright.
Deep in the heart of Texas.
The Trump administration wants to turn down the heat on America's melting pot by creating policies that would slow the rate of even legal immigration. The president believes many foreign-born people are not assimilating to American society and are expanding the underclass. But what exactly does it mean to assimilate? NPR's John Burnett looks back to the 1970s when large numbers of Vietnamese refugees settled on the Texas Gulf Coast, and he tells us how they've fared since then.
On this day, 39 years ago, the Ku Klux Klan came to the fishing village of Seadrift, Texas. KPRC-TV in Houston covered the story and interviewed Louis Beam, the Texas Grand Dragon of the KKK.
In Texas, the Klan is mobilizing against these Vietnamese fishermen.
If they are to have this state, they will get it one way and one way only, just like the Mexicans got the Alamo by storm.
The Klan says it'll hold a rally soon at which it'll set fire to a shrimp boat meant to represent all those owned by Vietnamese.
After the fall of Saigon in 1975, the U.S. government helped 130,000 South Vietnamese resettle in America as political refugees. They were U.S. allies during the Vietnam War, but most Americans didn't want them in their backyard. Many Vietnamese made their way to the Texas Gulf Coast, drawn by balmy weather and fishing, a trade they knew well, only to be met by hooded Klansmen who told them America for Americans.
Really, they don't like us. Like, seem like discrimination, and they want to try to push us out. But we not give up easy.
Tay Nguyen joined the exodus from Vietnam and arrived in Seadrift in 1978 as a skinny, bewildered 21-year-old. He launched a crab boat in San Antonio Bay, whose placid waters are patrolled by pelicans and plied by sea trout and black drum. There was bad blood between the Vietnamese fishermen and longtime residents from the beginning, complicated by the language barrier. People were resentful the newcomers were getting help from the government. Also, they put out too many crab traps, according to Diane Wilson. She's a fourth-generation fisherwoman in Seadrift.
When the Vietnamese came and first started doing it, they would put 10 where there had been one. So they didn't know, and nobody told them.
Then tensions escalated. A local white crabber was shot and killed in a dispute with Vietnamese fishermen over fishing territory. Two Vietnamese were charged with murder and acquitted on grounds of self-defense. That's when the Ku Klux Klan showed up, and things got ugly.
After the shooting, it was like, poof! I know several houses got burned, several boats were set fire to, and I think a large number of Vietnamese left because they were afraid.
See, really, before, I didn't know about KKK or nothing, but it ended up when you get killed, the guy get killed, they show up, you know, they burn 2-3 boats over here, crab boat. We left after that.
Tay Nguyen and other Vietnamese crabbers fled to Louisiana for their safety. But many came back to Seadrift over time, including Nguyen, who started a family there and opened a bait shop on the town docks. He still traps blue crab. In his packing shed, workers dump a chest of ice onto a table. The cold quiets down the crustaceans. The Vietnamese fishermen have blended in. 40 years later, Sea Drift is more a mosaic than a melting pot. Vietnamese is still spoken around town, and they celebrate the Lunar New Year. Vietnamese kids attend Sea Drift School, home of the Fighting Pirates, alongside Anglo and Hispanic students. And everyone who makes a living on the bay is united against common foes, heavy regulations, ocean pollution, and cheap imported shrimp.
Really, I say everything right now, we work together. We fundraise, all that, like church and all that, we together to work. After hurricanes, needs help, all that, yeah, we good friends together.
150 miles up the coast from tiny Sea Drift, Houston is home to more than 80,000 Vietnamese, the largest population outside of California. Like the Astros, the NASA Space Center, and flooding bayous, the Vietnamese are now part of what makes Houston, Houston.
This is Radio Saigon, KREH 900 AM, Pecan Grove, Houston.
In addition to Vietnamese radio, street signs are in the native language, and the South Vietnamese flag, red stripes on a yellow field, flutters outside of faux noodle houses. Tao Ha is driving us down Bel Air Boulevard, the main street of the sprawling district they call Little Saigon.
Okay, so now you start to see, like, Tan Hoi sandwich shop. It's got Vietnamese language and English. And then Don's Cafe is a very popular banh mi shop.
Tao Ha came to Houston with her parents in 1975. She's a sociologist at MiraCosta College in California. According to her, the flinty fishing towns were not the only places hostile to Vietnamese back then.
There was some racism, some bullying from the neighborhood kids, you know, told us to go back to our country, and called us gooks and things like that.
Houston's Vietnamese community, like the one in Sea Drift, offers a lens through which to view the current climate toward immigrants. Some immigration hardliners consider these enclaves too foreign, and the Trump administration wants to admit newcomers based on skills and education, not family-based immigration, which is how most Vietnamese got here.
When Vietnamese came in 75 and 80, there was a governmental support. There were government programs to bring us here, and that's the complete opposite now, where it's doing everything that they can to turn away immigrants, to turn away asylum seekers, to push out those who are already here.
After the war ended, Vietnamese refugees carried with them a fiery anti-communism. Like the Cubans before them, many became staunch Republicans. That political fidelity continues today. Stephen Lee, a conservative family doctor, represents Little Saigon on the Houston City Council. He supports Trump's aggressive border security.
You know, obviously, I think all countries should have borders and making sure that there's not a lot of illegal immigration, you know, happening.
But he doesn't think the president should slow down legal immigration. In fact, Lee believes there's a way to make sure immigrants become part of the larger community.
I find the easiest way to assimilate and to be proud that you are an American is actually make them a citizen, plain and simple.
According to a recent study by the Migration Policy Institute, Vietnamese in America are thriving. Compared to other immigrants, Vietnamese have higher incomes, are less likely to live in poverty, and more likely to be naturalized U.S. citizens, though they lag behind in English proficiency. Mike Trinh is proud to be part of the prosperous Vietnamese business community of Little Saigon. After becoming a champion kickboxer, Trinh opened Mike's Seafood.
I can say it's an immigrant mentality. We work our butt off for everything. We carve a niche out of from nothing.
Mike's specializes in Vietnamese Cajun seafood, an Asian Southern fusion that's all the rage in Houston. Trinh leads us into the kitchen with bubbling vats of shrimp and the air pleasantly piquant.
We spice, we season everything, onion, garlic, everything. Vietnamese community, we like a lot of flavors. Some people with ginger, some people with lemon. Everybody has their own twist of how they do things.
Across town, we visit an historically Vietnamese apartment complex where we meet Mai Linh Tran. She's a 22-year-old math and science teacher who's also navigating two cultures. Tran stands outside of her parents' apartment that looks onto a Buddhist shrine in the courtyard.
I know a lot of my friends, my American friends, they're shocked because I'm still living with my parents, but they don't understand. It's a choice. And if I can, and if my boyfriend, I have an American boyfriend, it's okay with it if we get married. Like, I want to continue to stay with my parents. And he seems okay with it.
Her parents want her to retain as much of her Vietnamese identity as possible.
They don't really like it that I have an American accent when I speak Vietnamese, but they don't understand the fact that I have a Vietnamese accent speaking English as well.
The administration has removed the phrase, a nation of immigrants, from official terminology. Meanwhile, in Houston, city officials boast it has become the most diverse city in America, and the Vietnamese are deep in the heart of it. John Burnett, NPR News, Houston.
Seattle's a great place to visit because it has, I guess you could say, a little bit of everything, but I like to think of it as a lot of everything.
Washington's child welfare system is failing to adequately serve foster youth with the greatest needs. That's according to a new report out this week from the state's Family and Children Ombudsman. Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins has details.
To understand this crisis, consider the case of a 7-year-old foster child who spent more than a month in an adult psychiatric unit because there was no therapeutic foster home that would take him. After investigating, Washington's Family and Children's Ombudsman concluded the situation was clearly unreasonable and harmful to the child. While extreme, the situation reveals a gap in the system, a lack of placement options. It's also why nearly 200 hard-to-place foster youth spent more than 1,000 nights in hotel rooms between September of last year and September of this year. It's a crisis that's been building, and one the secretary of Washington's new Department of Children, Youth, and Families says he's working to address. That includes asking the governor and lawmakers to put more money into the beleaguered child welfare system and raise reimbursement rates for therapeutic foster homes. I'm Austin Jenkins in Olympia.
Alabama has the highest rate of cervical cancer death in the country. Black women in the state die from the disease at nearly twice the rate of white women. That's according to a report released today by Human Rights Watch, an international nonprofit. WBHM's Mary Scott Hodgen reports.
When identified early, the odds of surviving cervical cancer are very good. Amanda Klassing is a senior researcher who worked on the Human Rights Watch report.
This is such a slow-growing cancer. It is such a preventable form of cancer that if you have women dying from it, it means something else is wrong in the healthcare system.
The report says Alabama's high rate of mortality reflects statewide barriers to care, like not having access to a gynecologist and inadequate health education. It's especially a problem in the Black Belt, a poor rural part of the state. There, women may drive hours to get a checkup or to see a specialist if they can get transportation. The report says racial disparities also play a role, with Black women often diagnosed at a later stage than white women. Again, Amanda Klassing.
There are structural forms of racism that continue to exist in the health system or that are carryovers from abuses that existed years ago.
Human Rights Watch recommends increasing awareness of the HPV vaccine, which prevents the virus that can cause cervical cancer, and helping people follow preventative guidelines. It also advocates for Alabama to expand Medicaid. Poor, uninsured women in the state are at a higher risk of dying from cervical cancer because they can't afford treatment. Mary Scott Hodgen, WBHM.
Yeah, so right now there's an international conversation really going on with Me Too, but often only some women are making that conversation.
A new study finds there's an alarming lack of data about Native American women and girls who've gone missing or have been murdered in U.S. cities. One of the researchers behind that study is Anita Lucchesi. She comes from the Cheyenne people, who are indigenous to the Great Plains. She and her co-author, Abigail Echo Hawk, spent a year requesting that data from police departments around the country. What they found are that institutional practices allow missing and murdered indigenous women to, as they read in their report, disappear not once, but three times. In life, in the media, and in the data. Anita Lucchesi joins me. Anita, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Anita, much of this type of work has been focused in the past on Indigenous and Native American women living on reservations. But is your study specifically looking at urban areas?
Yes, the report focuses on this violence as it occurs in 71 cities across the country. And so I know that people like to imagine Native people as living on reservations far away from their communities, but we actually live everywhere where everyone else is too.
Is there an assumption that Indigenous and Native American women are murdered or disappear at a higher rate than other women in the U.S.?
Yes, murder is the third leading cause of death of American Indian women, and rates of violence can be up to 10 times higher than the national average on reservations. However, there are no statistics like that for urban communities, which is what this report sought to fill the gap for.
And when you requested those records and found that data was incomplete, what explained that?
So some of them were due to racial misclassification. So there's quite a few examples of cases where the victim was erroneously classified as white in the system, and part of that is due to those institutional practices. So, for example, Fargo police told us that if an officer doesn't enter in victim race, the system defaults to white. And then there's also just, I think, a lack of communication between law enforcement and victims' families and communities. You know, we're able to very clearly identify who's a member of our community. And for some reason, that's a question that's not being asked.
And do you believe that the end result is that there's an undercounting of Indigenous and Native American women who've gone missing or been murdered?
Absolutely.
Why does that matter? Why is it a problem if we don't have the numbers correct and they're too low?
We can't address violence we don't track. If we don't have any data on this violence as it occurs in cities, and we assume that it only happens in reservations, that means all of our funding, all of our community programs is going to be directed to those reservation spaces. And while that's still useful for reservation-based communities and definitely needed, it leaves out those urban families and communities. So any policy that doesn't address that violence as well is just not going to end the violence.
What do you think needs to be done to get a more accurate picture? And can it also be done retroactively or only in future reporting?
I think it definitely can be done retroactively. I would encourage all law enforcement agencies to digitize their archived case files. I would also encourage law enforcement to revisit their protocol for defining or entering in victim race. And I think require law enforcement to learn to track not just whether someone was Native, but their actual tribal affiliation is really useful, because tribal nations should be able to advocate for their citizens when they go missing or are murdered. But the problem is they don't even know when that occurs because law enforcement aren't telling them.
I've been told that this research is very personal for you, but I don't know the backstory for why you took this project on. Why did you?
So my first experience of sexual assault was in the Bay Area. I also experienced sexual assault in Albuquerque, life-threatening domestic violence and trafficking in Spokane. For me, there's been so many times when, you know, I experienced traumatic violence or I was almost killed and I almost became one of the women in this list. And because the narrative was so focused on reservations and excluded urban communities, you know, my experiences wouldn't necessarily have been counted. And that didn't sit well.
That was researcher Anita Lucchesi of the Urban Indian Health Institute. She joined us from member station KHSU in Northern California. Anita, thank you and best wishes with your work.
Thank you.
WNYC, and this week, the last U.S. Senate race of the midterm elections was decided when Mississippi Republican incumbent Cindy Hyde-Smith hung on in a runoff to defeat Democrat Mike Espy, despite multiple instances of racial insensitivity on Hyde-Smith's part that came to light. Only one of those got much coverage outside the state. We're going to take a closer look at one of the others now for a sense of history and how it still affects the present. The one you probably know is her joke that she liked one of her supporters so much she'd be in the front row at a public hanging with him. She was numb to history at best with a joke like that, as many people have now realized, since Mississippi was the number one state for lynchings, with more than 650 counted from the Civil War through the Civil Rights era, many of them public hangings. It took Cindy Hyde-Smith days of public pressure to grudgingly say any words of apology at all.
There was no ill will, no intent,
whatsoever.
So that's the Cindy Hyde-Smith controversy you know. Another was a photo that surfaced of her from 2014 wearing a Confederate flag hat and holding a rifle at the Museum for the President of the Confederacy during the Civil War, Jefferson Davis. She said at that event, and again, it's 2014, not, 1984. She said at that event that the museum was Mississippi history at its best. Another one involved another joke, sort of, that made light of voter suppression, which, of course, has racial overtones as well as other overtones, when she said laws making it harder for college students to vote, quote, remind me there's a lot of liberal folks in those other schools who maybe we don't want to vote, and I think that's a great idea, unquote. And finally, it got revealed just days before the election that she had attended a so-called segregation academy set up in Mississippi and subsidized by tax dollars as a whites-only option after the courts ordered public schools to be integrated. What's more, she sent her daughter to one of the schools that was founded that way. It's those segregation academies that are the main focus of an op-ed in the Times by Cornell University's Director of American Studies, Noloway Rooks, who is also author of the book Cutting School, Privatization, Segregation, and the End of Public Education. She was last here for a book interview, and that came out. And Dr. Rooks, thank you for coming on again for this. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you so much for having me.
So Cindy Hyde-Smith, born in 1959, attended for part of her schooling the Lawrence County Academy in Mississippi. Would you begin by describing the origins of that school?
Yeah, so both that school and the school that she sent her daughter to, Brookhaven Academy, or what's known as segregation academies, these were schools that were founded in the South in the decade following Brown v. Board. I'm sure most of your listeners know Brown v. Board of Education was 1954. There was a lot of wrangling for at least another 10 years before it looked like anybody would need to actually think about integrating. So from 1964 on, all across the South, but Mississippi was actually a founding place, one of the first places that this happened. White parents, fearing that they would actually have to send their kids to school with black children, began to found private, quasi-private schools. And because they were private, Brown didn't apply. So private schools did not have to abide by the new integration laws and ruling. So these schools sprang up all across the South. And the notable thing about them was not so much just that they were segregated by race. What I argue is what's notable is that because state legislatures in the 11 former slaveholding states consistently allow public tax dollars, state tax dollars, to go to white parents to offset tuition costs to send them to these private schools. The impact of it was to create underfunded, all-black public schools in those states.
And if I have the timeline right from your article, Cindy Hyde-Smith, as a kid, started attending this school in 1970.
Yes.
And this is not 1870. This was
right.
1970, 6 years
yeah.
after the Civil Rights Act was passed, 16
yeah.
years after Brown versus Board of Education, as you
yeah.
were saying. Why 1970?
Well, that was the first year in Mississippi that the court said, okay, we will pull all federal funding from you right now today unless you integrate those schools.
Uh-huh.
And stop with all of these half measures. Stop with all of this fake, we are integrating. Look, we have one child in the 500 school class. That's integration for us.
Mm-hmm.
The federal government finally got very, very serious, and the stick that they used was money. More than anything else. So that year became clear, 1969, in December of 1969, lawmakers, the governor got clear that it would literally bankrupt the state if they continued with this stance. And so they said in January of 1970, we're going to have to start integrating schools. That's when the school that she went to was founded.
And where did the term that's been attached to these institutions in this story, which I think a lot of people in the New York area never heard before, segregation academies, come from, if you know, and how long ago?
Well, the first school started to be founded in 1964. The segregation is really just because they're for all white people. Like, they're only for white citizens. And then the academy part is that quasi, you know, like, you, there are a lot of private schools that have academy attached to them. So it really signaled to anyone paying attention, if you saw any all across the South, if you see these schools with academy at the end, one of the first questions many people will ask is, when was it founded and is it one of these schools? There were not significant numbers of private schools in the South predating 1970 or 1964, when you really start to see this explosion taking place.
Mm-hmm.
But between 1970 and 1974, you go from a few hundred to 3,500 across the South, and you go from a handful, a few thousand white students being educated in private schools and academies to almost 750,000 in just a 4 to 6 year period. Again, it's the period when the courts really said, you Southern people, if you do not integrate these schools right now, you know, there'll be no more money for you. That's when you see the explosion. So the segregation academy is just acknowledging that's what they are aiming to keep alive. They want to continue segregation.
Yeah. And for the sake of history, which I think especially a lot of white people don't know, that even after Brown in 1954, they could still legally have a declared whites-only private institution until the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. So Johnson was the first one President Johnson, in that Civil Rights Act, you know, had been bouncing around back and forth, boxing around with different governors around, come on now, we need y'all to move forward. We need y'all to move forward. And in that Civil Rights Act, he said, you know, we will start to defund you. It took till 1970 till they were really about to pull the plug. But that was the first time where the federal government took a financial side in order to try to break up the segregation in the South. So in Mississippi, like the thing that is, I think, notable and all across the South is the ways that they allowed these academies, these segregation academies, to be funded and to use tax dollars to do it. They would do things like, there were a number of different ways, but in Mississippi in particular, they had tuition grants. So each white parent only, and this is the thing, they were able to speculate, to say, this is only available to white parents. White parents can have up to $240 in tuition voucher, a state tuition voucher that they can take to one of these segregation academies to offset the cost for sending them to these schools. And in Mississippi, that meant where you know, this election just took place, that meant that white parents could pay between 50% to 90% of their child's tuition, depending on the school and the tuition that was charged. They could pay from half to almost the full amount on taxpayer dollars. And in the court case that challenged this in 1971, they found that of the 48 segregation academies in Mississippi at the time, or 49 academies at the time, 48 were white only. And so that literally meant that taxpayer funds that black families were also contributing to, these were not just the money of the, you know, white parents were putting in. Taxpayer funds were going to subsidize the education of white students with other white students only.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the so-called segregation academies, their history and legacies to the present that have come into larger public view as a result of the personal history of the now senator-elect, I guess she was appointed previously, now elected from the state of Mississippi, Cindy Hyde Smith, on Tuesday. And we're talking about this with Cornell University's Director of American Studies, Nolowe Rooks, who is also author of the book Cutting School, Privatization, Segregation, and the End of Public Education. Maybe you saw her op-ed in The Times. So, Dr. Brooks, if the segregation academies as quasi-public institutions were ended by the courts in 1971, where does Cindy Hyde Smith's daughter come in?
Well, she chose – so you could no longer use these tuition tax dollars to fund the schools. However, different municipalities then came up with all kinds of different kinds of schemes. But that's let's get kind of in the weeds. Mm-hmm. However, the schools maintain, like, their history of founding wasn't unintentional. And so if people had to dig into their pockets, interestingly, they often launched campaigns and asked people in the North to send money to these schools through their different networks. Churches are taking up collections to send south to allow these segregation academies to continue. So they maintain this general kind of character. So a school that Cindy Hyde Smith's daughter attends by 2016, you know, it's founded in 1970. It's a segregation academy. It's founded to keep white students together. In Brookhaven, Mississippi, the school that Hyde Smith's daughter goes to in 2016 has one black child in it. 386 students, one black child, four Latino students out of 386 students. So they managed to maintain the character of the school. They just no longer received the state funds mm-hmm. to do it. So her I just find that shocking that you have a private school that is in a town that is over half black, but somehow the school only has one black child. That doesn't happen by accident. That doesn't happen by accident. That doesn't happen by accident.
Before we let some of our listeners feel too superior hearing this story, how different is that to you from the kinds of school segregation issues we have in the North to this day, like right here in New York City, where gifted and talented programs and things like mm-hmm. that also have the effect, at least, of publicly funding segregation?
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the things that I've been hearing in response to the op-ed, one is the number of people, like you said, are there any people there with this history? I've heard from so many people all over the country who, you know, were saying it really takes them back. This is, in fact, the history that they remember. The other one is, as is true, people saying if the South was segregation academies and using funds to segregate and for white students to be able to hoard money in that direction, in the North, you're looking at suburbs. Like, what happens from 1970 on in the non-South? So in the East, in the Midwest, what you see is literally not just white parents founding schools in the same towns. What you get are a mass exodus to suburbs where it's not the case that black students just can't come, that you're not allowed to come, but they make it very difficult. So those funds, those taxpayer funds are also drained from urban school districts en masse starting in the late 1960s. Through 1970, and you end up with the same thing. The money followed the white students, and you have underfunded, struggling majority of color school districts left in urban areas. To an extent, that's not New York City's history. You do not have that kind of mass exodus, but New York City has a whole other history of fighting against having a desegregation plan, a citywide, district-wide desegregation plan. The city has never had one, and the marches and that period in the late 1960s in New York City shows how similar kinds of ideologies take hold and take root in the North.
Well, see, again, the people who classify themselves as white are not happy with their appearance. Now, they've taught us to be unhappy about our appearance. You see, but they're very unhappy about their appearance. I think there's an article in the handout about a woman who was, white woman who was in Hawaii, and she said that being around the Hawaiian people and the Asian people, and she said she was tall and white and pale. She said she felt like a freak. And so then she started getting involved in genetic science.
A Chinese scientist who says he's helped create the world's first gene-edited babies has revealed there is another pregnancy involving a gene-edited embryo. Professor He Jiankui revealed on Monday that he'd altered the DNA of twin girls to prevent them from contracting HIV. Today, he addressed the Human Genome Editing Summit in Hong Kong, and he spoke about the controversy surrounding his work.
Enhancing IQ or selecting hair or eye color is not what a loving couple does. That should be banned. I understand my work will be controversial, but I believe family need this technology, and I'm willing to take the criticism for them.
Our China correspondent Robin Brandt was in the audience. He said Professor He did not offer evidence of his work dating back to 2014, which has yet to be independently verified.
It looks like it is a world first, involving genes that had been edited by human intervention in children that have gone on to be born normal and healthy, we are told. But the big problem about Dr. He's presentation today, and look, we were surprised, like me people, that he actually turned up, was that it lacked detail and littered with ambiguity. There's been no peer review. He said, though, his work will now be published in a journal. He didn't say what journal that will be. He mentioned several experts who'd looked at his methodology along the way. He didn't say who they were. He couldn't give any details about these girls. They're called Nana and Lulu, apparently born in Shenzhen, a city in south of China, not far from here. But he didn't say where they are now, who their parents are. He did make that intriguing revelation about another pregnancy, but very, very early stages. But there were some real problematic revelations that many of the experts in the audience, and I sat there, really struggled with. I mean, it turned out only four people apparently reviewed what's called the informed consent. That's the consent the volunteers in this trial gave. They had an hour and 10 minutes to consider whether they wanted to be part of it. All this was symptomatic of a methodology that's very, very troubling for many of the experts who were in the audience.
Well, that concern is shared by many geneticists around the world. Professor Joyce Harper is director of the Centre for Human Reproduction at University College London. James Menendez asked her what she made of Professor He's claims.
Unfortunately, I do think that he may well have transferred an embryo which has created these twins, that he has actually performed genome editing on. I was a bit sceptical on Monday and was hoping that it might not actually be true. But now from his speeches today at the gene editing conference, I think most of us now feel that he has actually done that, which is actually more worrying than I felt on Monday.
Yes, I was going to ask you, how worried are you that he's done this, and were the necessary safeguards, if they exist, in place?
I'm very worried now, and I don't think he could have done the necessary safeguards within the time frame. So within science, what we do is we do our research and we publish our work in peer-reviewed journals so that we can have the views of the rest of the scientific community. And the papers that have come out so far on genome editing, and there have been numerous, it's growing exponentially, and quite a few of those on editing the genome of the embryo, they have shown that at the moment, this technology is not imminently available for clinical use. There are many things that we have to sort out. Two main problems, one called mosaicism, where we see that the edit hasn't actually happened in every cell of the embryo. It needs to happen in every cell to be efficient. But the more worrying is what we call off-target effects. And these are where, okay, we're trying to edit a particular part of the genome, but these are where other edits have happened off target in different places of the genome. And that's an area of intensive research at the moment. But even when those two hurdles get sorted, we then have to do many years of establishing that the embryos that we generate have not been damaged in other ways. So there's years of work to confirm the safety of the technique. And you can never really confirm safety of anything that we do in science and medicine. But certainly to the best of our ability at this time, there's essential work that has to be done to really convince the scientific and medical community that we have not done any long-term damage to that embryo before we even consider transferring. So I think what he has done is he has edited the embryo and tampered with this gene, but he hasn't done any of those steps that I've just mentioned.
And why? Do you think he was cutting corners deliberately because he saw it as a race, or perhaps got so wrapped up in his research that he didn't think to wait? What do you think the motivation was?
I think it might be naivety from what I'm hearing from Hong Kong today. It seems that he's not really in touch with the scientific community. He apparently has left or on sabbatical from the university he had been working at because they weren't supportive of his work. And he did say something along the lines that other colleagues didn't agree with what he was doing. Well, if people don't agree what you're doing, and that the whole way science work is we peer review each other's work, we want the support of our colleagues. Now, not everyone will necessarily agree, but if nobody agrees with what we're doing and you're actually going against rules and regulations in your country, that normally should ring alarm bells.
That was the British genetics professor, Joyce Harper.
Some questions. Will robots take our jobs or work alongside us? Are we doing enough to educate the next generation of workers? How soon will technology radically change the workforce? These are just some of the questions we'll be exploring next week in a series called The Future of Work. Tonight, economics correspondent Paul Solomon starts us off by putting a few of those concerns into perspective. It's part of our weekly series, Making Sense.
First, the job scare story you've likely heard. Millions of humans replaced by robots. 75 million of them within 5 years, says the World Economic Forum. But it then adds 133 million new jobs may be created at the same time. That's what's called creative destruction. Here's Carl Frey of Oxford University.
This theme has been reoccurring from time to time for the past 200 years. If you go back to the Roman Empire, there are people expressing concerns over technological unemployment as well.
Why? Well, for one thing, losing a job really hurts. Roman Emperor Vespasian built the Colosseum without the help of labor-saving technology to move heavy columns because it would displace manual labor, threaten civil unrest. Remember the Luddites, who broke the high-tech textile looms of the early 1800s to save their jobs and were hanged for their efforts? The Washington Post employees who sabotaged automated presses in 1975. And it's not hard to understand why workers are so resistant to creative destruction. Here's MIT's Andrew McAfee.
Change is scary. We humans have a bias for the status quo. We don't want the boat rocked really hard. And it's always easier to focus on the destruction part than the creation part, for a lot of obvious reasons. It's easy to see this job being automated away. It's not as immediately clear what kinds of jobs, what kinds of opportunities are being created by technology.
Study after study has found significant physical and mental health effects of even one layoff, even when the person found another job. And Oxford's Carl Frey has estimated that almost half of U.S. jobs are at risk of elimination.
If economic history provides guidance, it suggests that we will continue to create a lot of new jobs as well. But even if we do, there is no assurance that the people that lose out to automation in the short run are going to be the ones employed in the new jobs that emerge in the long run.
Another problem with creative destruction, technological progress, automation, robots, they all threaten to amplify inequality, creating more high-paying jobs, possibly more low-paying jobs, but not nearly enough in between.
We see technology creating really good jobs, very high-paying jobs, really great careers. User interface designer is a great job. Data scientist, machine learning specialist, product manager at a high-tech company. These are really, really good jobs, upper middle class and above kinds of jobs. There's also a huge bulge of jobs being created down at the low end of the pay scale. And these are typically in-person jobs. They're typically service jobs. So we're not creating this big group of great middle-class jobs.
There's at least one more question worth exploring about the future of work. How fast are things going to change? Are the robots and driverless trucks just around the corner, or still miles and miles down the road? Again, MIT's McAfee.
Lots of technology changes are going to happen quicker than we think. And I say that for two main reasons. The first one is that all the elements, all the building blocks of really powerful technology platforms and companies, all those building blocks are improving super quickly. We got networks, processors, storage, bandwidth, and innovators and entrepreneurs are combining those building blocks in really interesting ways, and they're doing it faster and cheaper than ever before.
And so these are the questions we'll explore in next week's Future of Work series. Can a small Kentucky community that once relied on jobs of the past be transformed into a hub of jobs for the future? Will technology and automation hurt minority populations the most? Are robots going to take our jobs? Or will robot helpers, cobots, wind up working alongside us? Are truck drivers toast? And if so, in what time frame?
My movement.
Finally, how much demand will there be for the humanities in a high-tech economy? We'll try to answer those questions next week. For now, I'm economics correspondent Paul Sullivan.
The U.S. Supreme Court today is taking up one of the few remaining provisions in the Bill of Rights that is not yet applied to states, a ban on excessive fines. At issue here are laws that allow state and local governments to confiscate cars and cash and even homes if they are used in the commission of a crime, any crime. Here's NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg.
Tyson Timms wants his SUV returned.
They took my truck immediately. They took that the night that I was arrested, and they've had it ever since.
The police seized the 2012 Land Rover when Timms was arrested in 2013 for selling a few grams of heroin to undercover cops for $400. Timms pleaded guilty to one drug charge and was sentenced to a year of house arrest and 5 years of probation, plus $1,200 in fines and court fees. But the state of Indiana wanted more. It wanted to keep the truck and sell it because it was used in the commission of a crime. The trial judge thought that was extreme and ruled that the state couldn't keep the truck. A court of appeals agreed that confiscating the truck was disproportionate, but the Indiana Supreme Court ruled that the Constitution's ban on excessive fines does not apply to the states. Timms appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, which hears arguments in his case today. Indiana is defending what is known in legalese as civil forfeiture of the truck. The idea is that since the truck was used in the commission of a crime, it is in essence an instrument of the crime, which justifies the seizure. Indiana Solicitor General Thomas Fisher argues that the Eighth Amendment's ban on excessive fines was aimed at preventing fines so large that people would end up in prison unable to pay. In contrast, he says, civil forfeiture laws are technically against property. In this case, the Land Rover. Fisher says as long as the state can show by a preponderance of the evidence that the truck was used in the commission of a crime, the state can seize it.
It's just the property and that's it.
But Tyson Timms contends that the truck is much more than just property. He bought it for $42,000 with money from a life insurance policy after his father died. By then, he'd become addicted to oxycodone, prescribed for him to alleviate pain, and he eventually graduated to heroin. He moved to Marion, Indiana, and moved in with his Aunt Wendy in hopes of kicking the habit. But he fell off the wagon, leading to his arrest. Eventually, he found a free treatment clinic, got clean, and got a job as a machinist. But it's 35 miles away, so his Aunt Wendy lets him use her car.
You know, I've been lucky. Most people don't have an Aunt Wendy like I have. She's on dialysis 3 days a week. And because I have to use her car to go to work so we can pay bills, she has to take the bus back and forth to dialysis.
Timms' lawyer, Wesley Hoddit, will tell the Supreme Court today that the case is emblematic of the way civil forfeiture laws are used throughout the country as a mechanism to raise revenue for state and local governments.
Unless there is a limit on this power,
what the excessive fines clause was meant to be, you will see more policing for profit and lots of abuse.
Indiana, he notes, allows prosecutors to outsource civil forfeiture cases to private lawyers for a percentage cut, a third to a fourth of the recovery. Civil forfeiture advocates defend the practice as a way to take property away from those who've used it in a crime and use the funds generated by selling the property for the public good. In any event, argues the state solicitor general, the founders never intended to prevent civil forfeitures by state governments.
You know, removing offending property from the offensive use is something the governments have done since well before the founding.
But Tim's lawyer contends that the system has been weaponized in modern times. Alluding to the seizure of Tim's truck, he adds,
if that's enough to take someone's car, then it's enough to take someone's house if their grandson sells drugs on the street out in front of the house.
Over the last decade, state and local governments have seized cash and property valued at $3 billion under a Justice Department program that allows state and local governments to share proceeds with federal agencies. The Justice Department imposed some limits on the practice during the Obama administration, but the Trump administration has reversed those restrictions. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
We form like Voltron. We form like Voltron. Red Dawn, war bonds, rap, nasty like porn. Pass on, transform, arm, leg, arm. Supreme head, infrared, we form like Voltron. We form like Voltron.
Three current and former Chicago police officers are set to go on trial today. They're charged with lying about what really happened the night police killed 17-year-old Laquan McDonald. Officer Jason Van Dyke was convicted last month of second-degree murder for that shooting. But police reform advocates like Christy Lopez say this trial of the officers who allegedly covered for Van Dyke, this trial may get at deeper issues.
In some respects, I think this is more important because if we didn't have people willing to cover up for bad officers, we wouldn't have bad officers.
Patrick Smith of our member station WBEZ has more.
Officer Jason Van Dyke shot McDonald 16 times in October of 2014. He claimed that McDonald attacked him with a knife, and that even after he shot him to the ground, he kept trying to get up and attack him again. The shooting was captured by a police dash camera. The video showed McDonald walking away from police, showed him fall almost immediately after Van Dyke opened fire, and showed the teenager crumpled on the pavement as he took shot after shot. But the three police officers on trial backed up Van Dyke's version of what happened.
Not a single police officer on the scene who wrote up a summary of what they saw said anything that can be reconciled with the video.
Michael Robbins is one of the attorneys for McDonald's family.
You had this complete array of dishonest accounts, and there's this instinctual, immediate move to cover up and to close ranks.
We form like Voltron.
Now, Chicago police officer Thomas Gaffney, former officer Joseph Walsh, and former detective David March are set to go on trial because, prosecutors argue, they got together to cook up a story to justify Van Dyke killing McDonald. Here's Special Prosecutor Patricia Brown Holmes.
These defendants lied about what occurred during a police-involved shooting. The indictment makes clear that it is unacceptable to obey an unofficial code of silence.
Defense attorneys insist there's no conspiracy or any crime at all. They argue that prosecutors pounced on a few routine errors in police reports, exaggerating them to satisfy an outraged public. One attorney for the officers described the basis for the prosecution's case as a few pieces of bad paper. Here's defense attorney James McKay at a pretrial hearing.
This whole indictment is a sham, based not on evidence, but on politics.
McKay and his co-counsel say prosecutors are basing their case on a meeting between the officers hours after the shooting. But they argue those sorts of meetings are common after police shootings, and there's no conspiracy here. This is a bench trial, meaning a judge, not a jury, will decide the case. And police reform advocates say the outcome is vitally important to rooting out the so-called code of silence among officers. Christy Lopez worked in the Civil Rights Division at the U.S. Department of Justice until last year and helped lead investigations into police departments across the country, including in Chicago and Ferguson. She says it's rare that officers face any discipline at all for cover-ups, let alone go on trial.
I hope it sends a message to officers everywhere that it's not worth their careers and it's not worth their integrity to cover up for someone who's violated someone else's rights.
Now it will be up to the judge to decide whether these three officers are guilty of obstruction of justice, official misconduct, and conspiracy. or if all they did was make mistakes in their paperwork. For NPR News, I'm Patrick Smith in Chicago.
Let's see. There's a couple of questions, Gus.
Yes, sir.
Don't mind me asking you guys. What's going on with the, you know, that police woman who decided to break into, well, she found herself in that black man's apartment and she decided to shoot him. What happened? What's going on with that?
It's been almost 3 months since Botham Jean was killed at this complex. All along, Amber Geiger has maintained it was a terrible accident. Now a jury will decide if she should be punished for it.
We have to stand rejoiceful.
A block from the apartment where Botham Jean was killed, tonight's celebration over the indictment of his accused killer.
We celebrate at the same time knowing that the work is not done.
This is Amber Geiger's latest mugshot, taken this afternoon in Mesquite, where she surrendered. At a press conference announcing the indictment, Botham Jean's family wore T-shirts with the hashtag, Be Like Bo.
We miss our boy dearly. He didn't deserve that. He was such a sweet boy in his home.
Jean was inside his apartment when Geiger, a Dallas officer at the time, shot and killed Jean after her shift. She told investigators she thought she was in her apartment and that Jean was an intruder. Barry Sorrells is a former Dallas County prosecutor not involved with Geiger's case.
It's one of the most tragic situations I think I've ever seen in my history as a criminal attorney.
Back in September, Texas Rangers filed a manslaughter charge against Geiger, but a grand jury indicted her for murder instead, believing evidence shows she intentionally and knowingly killed Jean.
It seems like she intentionally intended to kill him. The question's going to be, does she have a defense?
Sorrell says a jury could still consider a manslaughter charge if they can't reach a murder conviction.
You're listening to the evidence.
John's family says they'll only be satisfied if Geiger goes to jail for his murder.
And more so of a penalty, the proper penalty that will cause her to reflect on what she has done and the pain that she has caused.
Tonight, Amber Geiger is out on bond. It'll be at least another year before the case goes to trial. If convicted of murder, Geiger faces 5 years to life behind bars. In downtown Dallas tonight, Meredith Yeomans, NBC 5.
Big Man Howard. His name was Elbert Howard, but few people called him that. To his friends and comrades in the Black Panther Party, he was Big Man because he really was a big man built like a football player. He was one of six men who originally joined and built the Black Panther Party. And he rose to Deputy Minister of Information, and for a time, he edited the Black Panther newspaper. He was born and raised in Chattanooga, Tennessee, but after he was discharged from the Air Force, he stayed in California. His impressive size and build, plus an impressive afro, made him a photogenic figure of a Panther. But he was, in fact, a soft-spoken man, albeit matter-of-factly. When most of the party co-founders were in prison or on trial, Big Man would step into the gap and tell the party story. He was an able, talented editor and writer and, when necessary, speaker. Elbert Big Man Howard returned to his ancestors recently after 80 years of life. Elbert Big Man Howard, Deputy Minister of Information, the Black Panther Party, all power to the people. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Every nigga is a star. Every nigga is a star. Who will deny that you and I and every nigga is a star?
A council in regional Queensland is under fire for publishing a funeral notice that refers to an Aboriginal man by using the N-word.
Nigger!
on November 8, Peru Shire Council posted a notice in its Facebook page for a local Indigenous man by the name of John Hagen. He'd been a long-term employee of the council. In the notice, it claimed Mr. Hagen was known by all by a derogatory term. It was the N-word followed by the word rat.
Nigger!
The post stayed online until last night, when it was eventually removed after the council received complaints from Mr. Hagen's family, who said they had never heard him referred to that way. Dr. Stephen Hagen is an academic, a writer, and first cousin of John Hagen, and he's on the line. Dr. Stephen Hagen, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Ben.
Can you tell me how shocked you were when you saw that funeral notice?
Well, it was brought to my attention prior to the funeral, and about a week or so prior to the funeral, I was absolutely appalled by that. Look, I'll preface my comments by saying that I'm aware that there were football buddies who referred to my first cousin with the use of the N-word, and he also had a nickname of Rat. But when I saw the notice on the Parish Shire Council's website referring to him as the N-word rat, I mean, whether the N-word's used as an adjective or a noun, it's still a demeaning word for people of colour. So I was quite offended by that publication.
I mean, what sort of council wouldn't have checks and balances in place, common decency and common sense to say, hang on a moment, are we really going to publish the N-word on our Facebook page?
Well, you would think that as a company, that organisation that gets its funding from the taxpayers, that there would be some checks and balances. And clearly, in this case, it wasn't. I mean, I think the very point to be made here, Ben, is that Australia is very casual with racism. I think people seem to think that it's okay that they're still living in a white Australia where, you know, what other people's feelings doesn't really matter. And certainly, they're not thinking about the feelings of people of colour when they made this insensitive racist reference to my first cousin in a Facebook post.
So the council has now removed it. Is that the end of the matter?
Oh, no. Look, I spoke to his children, and they're very keen to have some sort of accountability, even if at the end of the day it's the relevant state minister sending a message out to all councils to be doing checks and balances and making references to, racially offensive words in any sort of communication to constituents or to the broader population.
Well, I'm sorry that your family had to go through all of that, and thank you very much for coming on the line.
Thanks very much, Ben.
Dr. Stephen Hagen, can you imagine any organisation, including a council, putting out a funeral notice and including the N-word on the funeral notice? Something seriously wrong there.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade, we are not quite done with the audio segments yet. Now, there's one more clip. Certainly, I am not encouraging anyone to follow the NFL. However, Kareem Hunt, black male, he is a running back for the Kansas City Chiefs NFL team. For people who do not follow football, and I hope that's lots of Cal's listeners, the Chiefs this year have been very good. They're one of the best teams in the league. Mr. Hunt is very good. He is one of the best running backs in the league. In fact, the very popular football game that they talked about from, I think, last month, the Chiefs and the Rams, where they scored a whole bunch of points and everything, he was in that game. I don't know. He probably played well. He's very, very good. Anyway, so the video has come out showing Mr. Hunt in an altercation with a female that appears to be a white woman and him shoving her to the ground and striking her again, kicking her once she's down on the ground. And so this has generated a lot of attention. The NFL suspended him and the Kansas City Chiefs fired him, terminated his contract outright. So this is huge news for one of the best football players in the league. What is important is what they do not include. This report is at NPR, is what is not included. Now, NPR, they got a whole code switch team where all they talk about is race, not white supremacy, but race. discrimination, racial themes. That's all they talk about. We heard several reports where NPR, they were talking about those very issues. They got black people. They should have adequate staff, much better qualified than Gus T, to look at this report about Kareem Hunt and say, oh, wait a minute, included in all of this about this black male, black Miss Andrea, the man not, attacking this white woman within all of this. Several reports indicate, I'm just reading, the white woman told police that the incident began when she was kicked out of Hunt's hotel room after refusing to hook up with somebody in his entourage. Hunt's friend said that the woman was belligerent when she was asked to leave the hotel room and that she called Hunt
"nigger"
and hit one of his female friends. That detail is not included in the following from NPR.
We're going to go into sports now. Our Howard Bryant is standing by. The Kansas City Chiefs have released their running back, Kareem Hunt, and the Toronto Raptors are on a hot streak. How long has it been have we heard that, if ever? Howard Bryant of ESPN.com and ESPN the magazine joins us. Howard, thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning, Scott.
Kansas City released Kareem Hunt after a video that shows him knocking down a woman and kicking her was made public.
In February.
Nothing was done over this time, but the NFL suspended him now that the video is made public. What do you know about this?
Well, I think the first thing is you look at this, and I don't know anyone who's watched the video who's not appalled by it. It's incredibly disturbing. And there's no sound to it, but you can watch it. And then, of course, TMZ also obtained the interview with the young woman talking with police and then also with Kareem Hunt and some of his friends who were part of the altercation. And you watch this, and it's just very disturbing in so many different ways. I think one of the things that bothers me most about it is, having covered sports for all these years, you have to – it's very unspoken in the business, and I think you have to reconcile this relationship between these young men with all of this fame and all of this wealth and entitlement and the women who are in these different places and the relationships between those two, the expectations, and when those expectations aren't met, whatever they are, they can become violent. And you're looking at this, and when I watched that video, I was like, you can just count. Anyone who's been in the business knows that at some point this celebrity culture has to change, and the relationship between these young men and the women and what happens out there is just – you just see it happening so many times. And obviously, when you're watching the video, you can't go back and think and not think about the Ray Rice video a few years ago. And it brings you to the NFL and makes you think about there's the player responsibility side of it, but then there's also the league side of it. The NFL didn't want to know what was taking place here. They had this information. They trusted the player, and the player told them something that they believed not to be true. They have a security team. They have enormous resources. Yet they weren't able to obtain this video, but TMZ was. I don't think that the NFL really does take any of this seriously. They are as untouchable, or they act as untouchable as the players believe they are. And then things like this happen.
And at the same time, the Washington football team, whose name I will not utter, has claimed the rights to Reuben Foster just days after he was released by the San Francisco 49ers following an arrest for domestic violence.
Three of them, actually, Scott, and I think that's the other point. So you have these two bookends, and it speaks to a pattern of behavior for the league. The Washington, not only did they claim Reuben Foster, but on top of that, the people who made the decision, Bruce Allen, hasn't even really been public on it. They've stuck Doug Williams out there, the VP of personnel, to pretty much take the fall for this ridiculous signing. And once again, you think about what message this sends. And when it sends this message, it goes back to the very same thing. They don't care. They're a $12, $13 billion industry. They have no interest in any of this because there's no sanction. When the business is affected, then maybe they'll care, but you cannot look at the NFL to be a moral compass on this.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, December 1, 2018. So I have been told this is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, questions, counter-racist suggestions, or any other items that you would like to offer, the number 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Few things before we get started. Hopefully folks can bear with me, be patient. It's been rough 24 hours, rough year all the way around. We lost Scandal. Shonda Rhimes hit all those years. No more Scandal. We lost John McCain, the great. Different world we would have maybe never had that Obama in the first place. And then the double whammy of them all, G.H.W., George Herbert Walker Bush, no longer with us, 94 years old, former head of the CIA, former president, former vice president. I mean, what to say? What to say? G.H.W. In fact, the only thing that I have been motivated to say, even though I do think there are many things that could be said about his tenure and his efforts, what I think could be, one could easily and logically conclude his efforts at maintaining, refining, expanding the system of white supremacy. Willie Horton, I think the book that we're reading, Dr. Tommy Curry, The Man Not Race, Class, Genre, and the Dilemmas of Black Manhood. I don't know if Willie Horton is mentioned, but he should be. I asked, I'm going to try to see if Dr. Curry can give us a few words to place Willie Horton in context with George Herbert Walker Bush. Willie Horton, The Man Not, put all that in context. We talked about Mr. Horton on the program before. I remember Nixon's Piano, Dr. Kenneth O'Reilly, multiple time guest on the program. We talked about Willie Horton. In fact, Mr. Bush may never have been president were it not for Black Miss Andry, the myth of the black rapist, and Willie Horton. I posted his Willie Horton political commercial on Twitter so that you can see it. Maybe people have not seen it, but it's infamous. It's something that's talked about in a lot of political classes. If they do a little bit on presentation on racism, infamous. Donald Trump gave a similar version, many people said, with all the talk about raping migrants coming into this area. And we got to, you know, watch out for the white women. But George Herbert Walker Bush, no longer with us. Trying our best to maintain, I know. A few other things before we get to listeners. We are listener-supported counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. Hit the blog racism-notes.blogspot.com. The address again, racism-notes.blogspot.com. When you hit my blog, the PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you are not into PayPal, drop me an email and we will get you a physical mailing address. Tremendous thanks to all of the listeners who have invested, supported for almost a decade. We are slowly encroaching on the 10-year anniversary of the cows. I hope the broadcast has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy. You can also support, if you do not do PayPal and all of that, you can support, nab an item from the wish list. It is amazon.com, linked under Gus T. Renegade. You'll see a link on my blog for my Amazon wish list, or you can just do the search at Amazon, Gus T. Renegade, and my wish list will pop up. Tremendous thanks, appreciation to all of the investors who have grabbed items from my wish list over the past decade. Again, I hope the program has provided accurate information about what it means to be white, what white supremacy racism is, and how it works. Other things to share. The Cows has been under extraordinary attack for the entire time. I mean, from broadcast number one, we have been under attack. You cannot be lazy and listen to the Cows. And what I mean when I say that, we literally suspected racists have terminated our broadcast while we were live on air. That has happened. We've been kicked off the air more times than not. So you can't just take it for granted, like, oh yeah, it'll be, you know, on iTunes or wherever you listen. It'll be available for me to check out at the channel. Anything. They could take the content down, delete it, really make an effort to be active if you think the content is constructive, worthy of your time and energy, to make sure, because things do happen in the system of racism, white supremacy, and you should expect that. Racists, they generally are very disruptive to non-white people who make some effort, even if, you know, they're super confused, and I am, they still make an effort to be disruptive. Dr. Kenneth O'Reilly, that's one thing that I learned from him, not about George H.W. Bush, but in his other book, Racial Matters, he talked about how they had COINTELPRO programs, probably affiliated with George H.W. indirectly or directly. But they had programs where they were spying on black people who had $33 in the bank. Now, I don't know, you know, how much hijacking, how much mischief a nigger can cause with $33. But if they're watching, I'm sure a whole lot of our listeners have more than $33. That's all you need to know about racism, white supremacy, and the dedication to maintaining domination over everyone classified as not white. So do not be lazy in listening to the Cows. And just the nature of the attack, the disruption with the iTunes feed, that's been pervasive for over a year, intermittent, where I've not been able to update the iTunes feed. We are available at SoundCloud, Black Talk Radio Network, YouTube, courtesy of Mr. Fox, and Google Play, among other outlets where you can access the Cows archives. They are current. But the disruption to the iTunes feed, we had disruption to people even being able to call in to the program at all. And one of our listeners in Canada, B, she has dialed in regularly. She wrote in. She said she tried to call in for workplace racism, which was yesterday, and she tried to call in last week for the compensatory call-in, and she was blocked. She said, I tried to do a workaround and applied a service to my monthly account for $5 so that I could make unlimited calls. Even though I've been able to call in the past, the same number brings up a voice prompt indicating that the number for the call-in show is non-existent. I literally tried 8 times. I wanted to forward information to you in case there are other non-white Black Canadians attempting to call in and cannot get through for a successful connection. I don't know. I've heard this from other people who are not necessarily in Canada, but consistent, and for years, people that are in the States and other parts where they dialed in and then something bizarre happened where they were not able to dial in. Just lots of different ways of causing disruptions. You can drop me an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. If you are having problems, I do try to give different alternatives like the vote blind and all that. Well, you can dial in live or you can call in and still participate if you want to share commentary. But this is the system of racism, white supremacy. And I've said this for almost 10 years. If we were on here and it was, you know, we're going to talk about who's the coon of the month, or it's almost the end of 2018. So who's the coon of the year? If we were going to be on and talk about that and call Black people names, Sambo this, coon that, I don't think we would have all of these disruptions. I think you would be able to easily call in Canada, Singapore, anywhere in the world, and we could coon it up for 3 hours with no problem. Next, I was asked by, I think, Princess and even others, what is up with the yoga fascination. That's not something that Gus was talking about or into for 10 years that we've been broadcasting. I don't think you've been hearing Gus talk about doing yoga or any other exercising. However, that has been my 2018. I think I could probably count on, truthfully, I think I could probably on two hands count all of the days this year that I have not done yoga. And I think that would be a truthful state. I think I could probably on two hands count the number of days that I did not practice at all. That being said, the reason that it has been so helpful and that I've enjoyed, there are many, many reasons. It would take a long time, more time than I could share here. If I could share a few, the sound clip that I played, nothing tastes as good as being healthy feels. Great quote. I concur to the highest. And the system of white supremacy is so debilitating to the health of Black people specifically. And in so many ways, keeping healthy food from us. You heard some of that in the reports, but in so many ways. And so just, I think I've talked about the weight loss alone. I think anybody, if you are morbid obese, when they say you are 40 pounds or more over your what is a healthy body weight, I certainly would have qualified. So to lose 40 pounds, I think you would feel better. And just getting regular exercise, yoga does so much for your whole body. It's absolutely wonderful. It's a great way to de-stress. I mean, there's so many benefits. And I originally was just doing the teacher training so that I can improve my personal practice and then not have to go to the studio with the suspected racists to practice. I could practice on my own competently. But getting the training, and we had Satya X on the program. In fact, I can even share, this is how much I have learned. Satya X, Black female, she was on the program live from Costa Rica earlier this year. Love the broadcast. She too is a yogi. She has the retreat in Costa Rica for Black women to come down, do yoga, and eat healthy vegan food. She talked all about it, racism, white supremacy, back in March of this year. Now, I had only been practicing yoga for about 2.5 months at that time when she was on the program. And I've been keeping in touch with her. I emailed her about a week ago and was like, wow, it seems like eons since we last spoke. But, you know, I've got my 200-hour teacher training certified and got my 85-hour prenatal certification and, you know, looking to teach some prenatal yoga to Black moms. Supposed to be meeting my prenatal teacher this week to see about setting that up. And she wrote me back, I think, within the same day. This is what she said. I just got back home to Costa Rica. I was in the South with my family. Whoopee. Congratulations. Congrats on the yoga teacher training. You have to use that certification to spread yoga and veganism to Black people. It's vital. I'd love to help you giving yoga to Black moms. And I've had quite a few folks who have contacted and said that they, you know, anything that they could do to help out, let me know. Some of them live here, some of them don't. But that is, these are a few of the reasons why. And even a different, totally different Black female that I did teacher training with was saying, you should teach yoga to Black people, because I have talked to tons of Black people who said they would be down to try yoga, but they are not excited about going to practice with a room full of race soldiers. I totally understand. The same, I suspect, would apply for Black people who might be interested in learning to teach yoga, wouldn't want to do this with a class full of whites. Have teacher training. Anyway, I'm going to see if I can do enough training to become competent to do the training aspect as well. I think it's that beneficial. Yoga can do so much. It's absolutely amazing. Absolutely. Can't say enough about it. Moving forward. Few other things I wanted to make sure, and even the veganism, I cannot minimize that because I really have feel like I've talked more about the yoga than the veganism. To have lost about 90 pounds in one calendar year, yes, the yoga is a lot of it. Being vegan is also a huge component of that as well. What even I'm thinking, what did I have to eat today? I had an Arkansas black apple, among other things, bananas and all that. I had tortilla chips too, but I had an organic Arkansas black apple. I'd never even heard of such a thing. Super sweet, super dark. I've never seen apples that dark before, but wow. Super tasty. I cannot emphasize enough the importance of eating correctly and trying not to eat all that garbage and trash that they offer us in the system of white supremacy. Dr. Kanban talks about that a lot, and he should. Even recall yesterday on workplace racism, that was the lunch, going out for a lunch, business lunch, and getting, I think it was white, was it trailer trash tacos? That's what it was. Trailer trash tacos. I cannot imagine what is on such a concoction, but I will take that black Arkansas apple any day over the trailer trash taco. Now, other things that stood out. Man, I am so glad I did not forget Doug Williams. I was going to say something about that, but I will leave that for retired firefighter. We talked about Doug Williams last week. The report on Kareem Hunt, the Redskins at the end. We talked about Doug Williams last week. I was going to say so much about that, but I will leave that for retired firefighter. I deliberately put the laugh track in on that segment with Doug Williams. Wow. Let me back up to Kareem Hunt, because that was in the same segment. I'm hopeful and certain that many Cows listeners have no idea who Kareem Hunt is. Spectacular. You do not need to watch any sports or any of the games tomorrow. Outstanding. This is a black male football player was on the Kansas City Chiefs. Very good player. Apparently, they released a video very similar to Ray Rice. And I've said this, racists, one of their tactics, in my view, for practicing racism, doesn't matter whether Kareem Hunt did anything correct, incorrect. That's not the point. What they will do, they'll have evidence, video footage, and they'll wait. This incident happened at the beginning of the year. They wait. It's almost 2019. And now the video comes out. Oh, my gosh. Look at the savage Kareem Hunt. And look at what he did. In my view, anytime that sort of thing happens, automatically, whatever the incident is, this is an act of racism, white supremacy. Even with the revelation of truth, sometimes they will reveal something that's true. Mr. Hunt did this in the video. However, we're not revealing it for correct purposes. We're revealing it now, months after it happened. It's being revealed for the practice of racism, white supremacy. That's the conclusion that I always take on these matters. Words. This is compensatory calling. We're supposed to be mindful of words. There was a report in the Big Lead today talking about this. As I said, Kareem Hunt's team, very good. He's very good. Pro bowler. So this got a lot of attention in the sports world and beyond. And this is a part of Me Too. And in general, system of white supremacy. What I just say, the man, not the black beast rapist. You got a black male putting his hands aggressively on a white woman. So, of course, this is going to be a big deal. So the title of the report for the Big Lead is Dr. Francis Cress Welding. The title is Video Shows Kareem Hunt Bull Rushing and Making Physical Contact with Woman in Hotel. Bull rushing. That's the word that they use to describe Kareem Hunt. They go on in the article to say that he exploded on this white woman. I mean, they really burst out the thesaurus to get technical with their use of terms. The most important I read about the allegations that this suspected racist white woman called someone a nigger and, you know, whatever else, her rule in all of this, emphasize it all the time, as Dr. Curry does, the role of white women in the system of racism, white supremacy. I've said for almost a decade, no one rallies violence against black people better than, and I say white women, really, I've emphasized it should be singular, because often it just takes one white woman, and that is all she wrote. Pardon the metaphor, but that can be a lethal conclusion. Frequently, just one white woman, one tear, she might not even have to cry, one white woman, and one allegation, and that will be that. Mr. Hunt fired and suspended. So even if another team decides that they want to hire him, he couldn't play because the NFL has suspended him. System of racism, white supremacy. White women are extraordinarily dangerous. Other things I wanted to make sure I touched on quickly before I get our callers. They mentioned in the report talking about Mississippi, the elected Senator Cindy Hyde Smith. They mentioned Mississippi, 650 hangings, lynchings in the state. In my view, that is a gross undercount, has got to be, especially if they're counting from the end of the Civil War through any point in the 20th century. I mean, wow, 650? Does anybody here think that's a reason? I mean, Brian Stevenson, they did all that work a few years ago saying that the countings of lynchings has been grossly misrepresented anyway. So I think that's extremely important. 650 for just the state of Mississippi? No, I don't think so. In the same segment, going back for a second to Doug Williams, I'm not saying anything about, I'll leave that for a retired firefighter, but in the segment about Doug Williams, the announcer for NPR had the audacity to say that team in Washington, whose name I will not utter. Are you serious? The tackiness of it all. The team's name is the Redskins. Now, you all, whites collectively, have sat around for centuries and made all of these slurs. If whites didn't want that team to be the Redskins, they wouldn't be the Redskins. I've seen whites, they have the ability. What is it? Hey, we'll just fine you. That'll be that. You want to keep the team named the Redskins? Fine. It'll be $10 million a day if that's the way that you want to keep the team. They could do it. I've seen what happened to Donald Sterling. They didn't want him to own the team anymore. He's out of the league. If they wanted that name to be changed, it wouldn't be that. Don't give me that. I don't even know what that is. Shame? Guilt? I find it reprehensible that they're named the Red. Come on. Come on. That's the same thing with nigga. Don't try to sanitize the racism, white supremacy. If it was named the Coons, call it the Coons. I wish it was the Coons, the niggers, the Sambos, any of that. That's what it is. In fact, I'm never going to call them Washington again. It's going to be Redskins every time, as long as we're in the system. Or even if they change the name, I think I'm still going to call them the Redskins. Make it fragrant. You bragged about this for a long, long time. Just make it plain. Stand by what Mr. Fuller said. Stand by your work. The audacity. Continuing. In the same words, Brian Lehrer, when he was talking about the report on Mississippi, and he was talking about all of the things that they did in the South. We covered so much of that. That's another one I think I could put Gus T next to, signature work, where we had white people come on to talk about the academies in Virginia. They closed their schools multiple times. We've covered all that in detail in the archives, where he said, Brian Lehrer, white man, he says, and this is in New York, this is on New York Public Radio. So he says, I don't want our listeners, our audience, to feel too superior. Now, I've had so many people over the decade who have said something to me about the word supremacy. He didn't want them to feel too superior. I thought that was extremely significant term to use, because a lot of times they'll say innocent. That'll be one. I don't want them to feel too innocent. I don't want them to feel. I'd have to think of some more. There are many other ways, but superior to describe how they might be feeling, whites presumably in the North, and hearing white people in the South be indicted for the way that they practice racism. And last one, I will share the segment where they were talking about how the computer programs were being used to make all these new jobs, and are we going to have robots taking jobs, and how is this going to look 20, 30, 50 years later? Creative destruction was the phrase that was used. And for me, I guess we have Welsing moment. For me, that was a Dr. Marimba Ani Yorugu moment, where she talks about, I think, her concept of Yorugu, talking about individuals classified as white, that they are mutated, not at ease, not at peace, and this is their destructive nature, to go out and destroy everything in creation, just the total imbalance with regards to everything about them and how they function to tear down and destroy nature, people, creation, themselves, each other, everything. That's what it reminded me of, to even have a phrase like that, creative destruction. That it's not, couldn't just be creation or imagination, evolution. It couldn't be any of that. Innovation. No. Creative destruction. Even in thinking about technology allegedly improving things, even then we got to add some destructive component. Like, we are going to get to rip up some things as we go about doing all this. Don't worry. Always going to make time to do some tearing up things. I'll stop there. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If you are ailing about Mr. Bush, try to maintain your composure through the broadcast, please. Much obliged. If you could take 5 minutes to share your commentary, that would be appreciated, just to make sure that everyone has time to share. If you know you are in a noisy environment, if you could use your mute button, that would be appreciated. That way we don't have to compete with a lot of unnecessary disruptions in the background. Much obliged. First few folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Again, it is *61 if you would like to participate.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hey, what's going on, Duff? This is Victim out of New Jersey. To reflect on George Bush, when I heard of his death, I thought about Katrina. As I was in the gym, I was looking at some of the news coverage on his death, and they brought up that him and Bill Clinton collabed on Hurricane Katrina relief. You know, I just kind of chuckled because I just remembered that wife of his who was in Texas, and the victims of Hurricane Katrina. She says that, you know, I'm not sure if they were in tents or they were in placed in a stadium, but to paraphrase, hey, they living better than they lived before. And I remember, man, I remember Katrina like it was yesterday. I was more confused then, but I've always been somebody who was never in denial about racism. I just really didn't have the words to articulate it. But I remember looking at TV in watching those victims that was referred to as refugees on top of homes. And I remember news accounts of accusations of babies being raped. And, you know, I was just in tears. And the funny thing is, and I'm going to get back to George Bush, these were liberal commentators. I remember Rachel Maddow, somebody who, I mean, a woman, an anchor that most victims would that's more confused would consider as an ally, was reporting on feverish black men raping babies. Never came on TV, never apologized. So George Bush, the Rodney King riot. He was the president under the Rodney King riots. So I'm no fan of the Bush family. Real interesting. The football player who is accused of attacking a white female in a hotel. That happened in February of this year. The news is just coming out now. Why is that? You know, this happened almost a year ago, less than me, you know. So why is this coming out now? I really have no opinions on it. I looked at the video, And I mean, no opinion. I got to gather my thoughts on that. That's all I have right now. If anything else, I want to add, I'll just add it to it then.
Barbara Bush, the comments at Hurricane Katrina, and I believe they were in a football stadium of some sort in the Houston area, where she made those comments that this was as good as they've ever had it. I mean, hey, you know, what's to complain about? They got cots and warm place. Never mind. Just thinking of Earl Butts. Never mind. Never mind. Other folks that we've not heard from at all.
Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
This is Jay in St. Louis. Took some notes. I wanted to say right off the bat, though, to add to the irony of the NPR broadcast about the football player and, you know, them acting all dignified about not saying Redskins. Here they are talking about an NFL player that plays for a team called the Chiefs. The Chiefs play in a stadium called Arrowhead. Here we are on stolen Native American land being dignified about not calling people Redskins. How Christian of them. But I took some notes in reference to the South Vietnamese immigrants. I think that's a case of honorary whiteness happening, or people being meritorious manumission, being commissioned into white to be white. This happened in, you know, if we recall South African apartheid, this happened with Japanese and Chinese immigrants there as well. As Neely Fuller reminds us, and Walter Rodney has reminded us, it is white people who determine who is white and who is not. And at different times, people who we would consider to be non-white, they will allow them to perform and occupy a certain social category. So I think that's what's happening with the North Vietnamese or the South Vietnamese immigrants being allowed to flourish in Houston. With the high cervical cancer rates for black women, I think the disease for black people, specifically in Alabama, I think it's no accident that the infrastructure of Alabama is 49th in the country. The only places worse is Mississippi. And I think that really aggravates some of the disease black people experience in that area. In regard to the Native American women who are experiencing that kind of trauma and going missing, I think it really speaks to the uselessness of white education, specifically within the social sciences, that Native American women, Native people of this continent, can't even have their tribal affiliations properly identified, even after death, to even tally up what they experience. The tuition grants, I also want to speak about that in Mississippi, regarding to the school that Cindy Hyde Smith attended. I think that's just another example of the ways that white people have abused so-called public funds and the uselessness of any kind of democratic project with racists. They will abuse public funds and public rights for their own private interests. We've also seen that take place with Medicare. It was a story published in the New York Times earlier this year about how even states who expand Medicare, which was a prescription given to two listeners from the person interviewed about Alabama's cervical cancer rates, they talked about expanding Medicare. Well, even when that happens, it's expanded in such a way that disproportionately allows whites to take advantage of those resources. Michigan was the state that took place in earlier this year. In regards to the gene editing story, I'm very suspicious of that story. White science. I noticed how the white woman came in at the end to kind of like represent an authoritative scientific voice. But I'm suspicious of white science in general. It's always been rife with dishonesty and falsities. On the other hand, if they happen to pull that off or happen to successfully gene edit human beings, I doubt that they've just begun that project. We know they like to safeguard information. So if they happen to complete that procedure, I think this is not the first time it's been done. In regard to the automation of jobs, so the political economy of whites, which, you know, they like the term capitalism, is undergoing changes due to the creation of what are called transnational corporations, who operate with no kind of international legal apparatus to inhibit what they do, where they go, how they disturb non-white people all over the globe and go and upend perfectly cohesive cultures and societies. We already know, even white economists admit that there is a central contradiction to the supposed inherent progressiveness of capitalism to spread development. It allows whites to accumulate profit and enrich a few at the expense of the many. And this has been documented since the 1600s. So, but I think even though, and related to that that notion of creative destruction, that goes back to a racist named, he was an economist. His name was Joseph Schumpeter. And he actually did a lot of work within their education system of demarcating the ways that their economy intentionally destroys things and then attempts to recreate things afterwards. I think somehow, some way, I think they will have jobs for their lower class whites, regardless of the automation. I think they'll racists, they always stay engaged. So, and then moving on to the civil forfeiture legislation. I think civil forfeiture is another process of white capitalism's accumulation, which just allows them to pretty much steal property from people, from the powerless. I also took notes for the Laquan McDonald story. What perplexes me about police departments and just the criminal injustice system in general is how it has managed to retain any source of legitimacy. This has happened in St. Louis this week as well. Four officers were federally indicted for lying under oath about attacking protesters after another police officer was acquitted through the same mechanism, a so-called bench trial. And then lastly, the Australian story. Australia is a white supremacist state like any other one. White teenage Australians were given great press this week protesting environmental injustice, and here they are using the N-word, disparaging Aborigines. So that's all I want to say.
Much obliged, Jay in St. Louis. That reminded me, the report in Australia, I'm absolutely certain that the whites were calling that non-white person nigger rat. That's what they were calling him. That's not what his name was. I'm sure he was not aware that that was his nickname, but that's what they were calling him. That's what they probably every time he turned around and went, "Hey, did you see nigger rat? Boy, we got to make sure we get nigger rat a card for Christmas this year. That nigger rat, wow, he is. And then when he comes back, they just call him his name. Then, man, that nigger rat is something. Wow. Make sure you tell him to get the trash. Maybe we'll give him a raise. I don't know. Was he here yesterday? Did you see nigger rat yesterday? That's what they were doing. It was just so, that's why they put it on the flyer. Like we always call, what are you talking? Oh yeah, we're not supposed, we normally don't. Yes, we shouldn't have put that on the Facebook page. Whoops. The system of racism, white supremacy is the oldest transnational corporation in the known universe. If we have anyone with the word guide, if I could make a request, if you could read what Mr. Fuller says about the word honorary white, much obliged. Others that we've not heard from at all, proceed.
Hello. Hello.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Thank you so much for taking my call. Good evening, everyone. Again, great clips. I don't know if this was mentioned last week, but recently I found out, I didn't really know her because we don't know a lot about our people like we should. But Dr. Olivia Hooker, one of the last survivors of the Tulsa the torturing of us. She passed away. She lived to be 103. You know, that's almost unbelievable in the system of white supremacy. But rest in power to her. A lot of interesting things about the Vietnamese. I agree with that as well, because you never hear of a black community being able, well, I guess what struck me is them being able to move back into the community that they were displaced from. I've never heard that with black people. Even when they migrated from migration, you hear about black people moving back to the South. They don't move back to the family farm or the family land. I only know of one person who moved back to land that was owned by the family, and that person happens to be my father when he moved back to South Carolina. So that's only because the other my family is still there. So he moved back in with amongst the rest of his family. The cervical cancer, I know we've talked about the birth rates with black women dying in birth. And I was watching, I guess it's called Sister Circle with Judge Hatchett, because something like that, an incident happened to her daughter-in-law, and she died right after childbirth. And I don't know, maybe you can get her on the show, because her being a lawyer, she can talk about the legal things and what we can do to fight. Because a lot of times we hear, oh, this is happening to us, this is happening to us, this is happening to us. Yes, we have to need education to prevent it, but when it does happen, I don't hear of anyone, they being able to sue or get any justice for their family. And her being a lawyer, she may be able to bring up those things because she has a lawsuit, she has a website, and she was really, you know, really passionate about it. She may be more than willing to talk about this issue on your show. So I saw that. And about the football people, I heard about the young man who was picked up by the Reds. They call it picked up, that's their term, by the Redskins to play for them after the incident. And we just have to remember, these teams, all of them, as far as I know, especially in football, I know are owned by white people. They make the final decisions. They are the ones who decide whether someone should stay or not stay. And when we think about, you know, them supporting women because they try to do that breast cancer thing, we know it's all a sham. Otherwise, if these incidents are really important, they would talk about them the moment that they happen or the moment that they hear about them, instead of waiting months or years or however long it takes, you know, until the person becomes so popular that they think they will become a star. That, okay, you cannot be a star now. Stop playing. And that's why we have to teach our children, if we have them while we're around children. You know, people don't want to talk about abstinence and things like that. But that is really not just, oh, for emotional sake, but legally and safety, that's what's going to save you. Just wait. Stay away. You know, it's not, I know it's not popular, but in order to save your life, to potentially have a career, that seems like the best thing you can do, you know, if you're not married. I know it's not again not popular, but, you know, save your life. And congratulations again on losing all the weight and being fat. I guess someone called you being fascinated with yoga or being fascinated with your health. We should all be so fascinated and be as healthy as we should possibly be. Thank you.
Amen. Amen. Taking care of ourselves or as best we can under current conditions. What was the name of the female that you suggested?
Oh, Judge Hatchett, Glenda Hatchett. Semi-popular judge. She had a TV show, Judge Glenda Hatchett.
Gotcha.
Other people may have heard of her.
Thank you. Definitely support having a sex code, all of us, regardless if Mr. Hunt made millions. So, you know, all of us have a sex code. Others that we've not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
May I be heard?
Greetings, Emmy.
Greetings, beautiful people. I'm going to try my best to relay some information about the CRISPR. I'm very excited about this clip. One, I've just been excited about it in general, although I will, you know, admit up front my feelings have changed since I first heard about it till now, primarily because I'm studying it, so I understand it a little bit more, and I think it's cool to understand, so I'm going to try to explain it. First, about the comment, just my comments about the clip itself. I learned or heard about this last week in class, and I geeked about it primarily because, you know, wherever he's from, I just know he's some type of classified Asian, but they're still non-white. And for me, I think that that's a bold move as a non-white scientist or just non-white people in general to do things outside of the standardized white collective, even scientific community. I am almost certain, like a previous caller has stated, that these things have occurred. Otherwise, we wouldn't even know it was a possibility, let alone for it to have a name like CRISPR, Cas9. So I do think there's enough evidence to suggest that it has occurred. The fact that he did it to, you know, create a child whose genetics would be immune to HIV/AIDS, whether people believe that's a real disease state or not, there is enough evidence that some people have a genetic predisposition to not, you know, they don't get HIV/AIDS even if they're exposed to it. So I think that that's great. And in part because there's enough evidence to suggest that white people created HIV/AIDS along with other viral, biochemical, medical, you know, agents of war. So if non-white people are able to use some of the science that we've acquired and studied and learned and whatnot to combat that, that's a very, in my position, powerful thing to do. And to do it without permission, to do it on your own, and to do it successfully is good. Now, I know he's not, you know, classified as Black, but hey, that's, in my opinion, a good thing for the non-white team. Some of the language that was used in the clip was very interesting, but I don't want to waste time on that. The Moaism, that's, you know, like that's a possibility, but that's a possibility with anything. And just to say that if we silenced, like we gave someone immunity genetically, that it would express other, you know, genetic expressions or phenotypes at the same time, we would only know that through experimentation. So I think it's worth the risk. And then to say that he was naive, I'm not so sure that that's accurate. And more power to him, you know. He didn't, like, do it for designer babies to give people, you know, blonde hair and blue eyes. It was to make someone immune to something that's really plaguing the world. Moving on, just to say a little bit about how it works, it's really, really cool because you're able to, and it's very simple to do. That's another thing. If you don't know about it, it sounds like you need all of this special, special stuff to do it, and you don't really. You just take bacteria, and their ability to produce a lot of DNA quickly. And because they're able to do that, they also take in a lot of genetic information. So when they're infected with a virus, they incorporate that virus into the DNA. So when they get attacked by another virus, they can compare it and say, hey, this virus is like something I've seen before. Let me cut it up and kill it. So they're able to add DNA quickly. So because of that, scientists were able to say, well, we could probably use this to, like, cut out certain genes and add in genes using the technology that DNA or that bacteria are able to do. And so when you can cut up DNA and then add in bacterial DNA or, you know, bacteria who make certain DNA, that's how you can get it into the DNA. And then once DNA replicates itself, that gene will be expressed. I hope I did, like, but I think it's important because, it's, you know, I don't know. I wasn't envisioning that before when I kept hearing about CRISPR and Cas9. I thought, like, really mad, evil scientist type of thing. But that's something that happened anyway. But when you know, you're taking it from two different species and adding it. So I don't know the implications. The truth is the science is here. So I feel that as I think that we're scientists and scientific minded, we've just been blocked out from these areas, from these specialties, and the more that we know, then we can use it. And so, yeah, I think I'll leave it there. If I figure out, like, some better way of explaining that, then maybe I'll try. But anywho, I'm excited about it. I did want to say this, in case there are other young people on the line. This has nothing to do with the CRISPR. Stay home if you can. I think this is in relation to, I think, the first clip or second clip, I can't remember which one, but Like, she's older, but she stays at home. She says something about it. If her boyfriend's cool with it, then she'll live at home too. That's pretty much how it is in most of the world. When you get out of the United States, like, younger people, like, stay home, you know, through college, and they stay home until they get married. And it's beneficial for everyone, not just for, like, the young person, but it's beneficial for the family. Financially, it's beneficial. It's healthy psychologically, and it's smarter. Because the quicker that you jump out there when you're younger, you're not really prepared, and it's easy to get caught up in a bunch of financial nonsense. And you spend more time trying to pay your bills than using your genius to do something else. So I know that not everybody has that situation. You know, things are different for everybody's home, but there's no shame in staying home, and most of the world stays home. And just, you know, that's like a delusion here in the United States, where they're like, you got to hurry up and get out your house and do whatever, whatever. So if you're young and you're listening to it, I'll just say stay home. All right, I'm good. Thanks.
Much obliged.
Can I be heard?
Much obliged, Emmy. Greetings, Mr. Steele.
Howdy doody, everybody. It's Ken Steele. I'm reporting from Koreatown in Los Angeles. I wanted to say, first of all, thanks, Gus, for having this program. Great clips in the beginning. The story with the football player that is going around in the news, honestly, like, I remember my days in college, and one of my hobbies, I'm going to say it was a hobby, I mean, I made a regular practice of this, was kicking unruly kicks out of my apartment. And there's a kind of an art to this, so that you don't do it in a manner that will incriminate yourself or any of the other people there. One of the things that you have to do when you do have an unruly woman inside of your apartment or house or place of residence is that you need to quickly recognize that the situation can go out of control. So you need to de-escalate whatever it is that is causing the disturbance or, you know, the disagreement. You know, there's a disagreement about a watch, somebody stole something, you know, money's missing, or just, you know, somebody's not down to play. If any of these things should arise, one of the best ways to de-escalate the situation is saying, all right, you got to get out. And then they'll typically look at you and say, wait, excuse me, I have to leave? And then you say, out. And then they'll be like, what? And then it's out, 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 out. And keep on repeating the word out, 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 out. You don't need to start yelling. Just anytime they want to start saying something, you go out, out, out. You know, and that usually coaxes them out of the door without any sort of physical intervention, you know. And then another thing is you do have to have a protocol, especially after this whole Me Too epidemic has arisen in our society. You have to have a protocol for, I guess, insurance for yourself. So either, you know, setting up some sort of nanny cam in your apartment, setting up some sort of a recording device whenever, you know, a woman is in your apartment. This is just standard practice. Me personally, I use my phone. Anytime I go into a woman's home, anytime I'm interacting with a woman outside of like a public business type setting, if I'm just, you know, me and her or something like that, I'm recording. I don't care how tacky, I don't care how uncouth, I don't care how, it may even be illegal in some areas to record. I mean, it might even straight up be illegal. However, I will take the misdemeanor for, you know, unlawful recording over a bogus rape charge any day of the week. I would take that over the felony any day. So record. If this woman, if she really did, you know, say all of those things and, you know, she was hitting people and everything, if they had a recording of all of this, they would have been able to quickly pull out that recording and circumvent all of this, nonsense that's being reported in the news about them. Have insurance. Guys, have insurance. There's another thing that related to this topic that's come up over the weekend. And they're trying to put Me Too style accusations on Neil deGrasse Tyson, who is the black astrophysicist that I guess has made a name for himself on television. And they're saying that he made a pass at one of his colleagues and that he groped another one of his colleagues. One of the things that I noticed about these Me Too cases is that it's not the women who are the people who are pushing this and making these claims valid. It is a lot of it are guys who are going along with nonsense claims. If you honestly, if you're listening to this and you are a believer in truth and justice, anytime you hear one of these accusations come up, especially against a black person, your default stance has to be, I don't believe it. Period. I don't care, just for defense, just for sanity reasons, and just for justice, you have to take the stance, I don't believe it. I have to see evidence. I have to see proof. I have to see proof. Until I see proof, I'm going to consider this a false story. It sounds like false narrative. And another step along that way is I see how racists have been able to circumvent any sort of absolve themselves of any sort of responsibility for dealing with any of the racist accusations that get levied upon them and that are proven to be true. At the end of the day, they will go, I don't care. And at the end, and I think that a similar stance needs to be taken by black people who are being forced to listen to all of these nonsense allegations against other black people made by racists. I think we should take a stance that whenever a racist makes one of these claims, we should just say, I don't care. I think you're lying. You need to leave. That's all. I'm going to go ahead and mute my line. Thank you.
Much obliged, Mr. Steele. I think it's the rule is supposed to be innocent until proven guilty. I thought that was the standard operating procedure. The number again.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir, Roz. Just I'm going to give the number one more time really quick. 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Roz, thank you kindly.
No problem. Greetings to you, Gus, and to the other callers and listeners. I'm going to try and keep it short. I have like three things I wanted to discuss briefly. Great program, great clips. I love what everyone had to say. I think I know that story of Judge Hatchett, so I do think she would be a great person if you could get her on to discuss that, because that was such a horrific tragedy, her losing her her daughter-in-law. And I would love to actually hear from her directly. So hopefully you'll be able to get in contact with her. First would be dealing with George H.W. Bush. I just want to read a little blurb from the back of a documentary I've had for a number of years now called Cocaine Country. And it's the story of Manuel Noriega. So it says, Noriega was the president of Panama who decided to be an informant for the CIA. George Bush, that's George H.W. Bush, was the chairman of the CIA at the time when Noriega flooded his country and the United States with tons of cocaine. Although George Bush knew of Noriega's dealings at the time, he allowed him to continue in the drug trade until the media exposed his dealings. When George Bush became president of the United States, he decided it was time to destroy Noriega. So that's another thing you can add to the legacy of George H.W. Bush. A heavy dose of crack and all kinds of cocaine throughout black neighborhoods in this country. So yes, wanted to lay that down. Next, the clip you played about cervical cancer. Recently, I did a show with my partner where we were discussing vitamin D3 deficiency actually it's the last show that we did in black people. And there was a very brief video where a black doctor discussed the fact that basically all black people who do not live in Florida or along that parallel basically are all vitamin D deficient, and that vitamin D deficiency, vitamin D3 specifically, which is the vitamin that your body creates when your skin comes in contact with the sun, that black people in this country are severely vitamin D3 deficient. And as a result, we get the most aggressive forms of cancer, which includes cervical cancer, prostate cancer, breast cancer, and that vitamin D3 is actually a protectant against those diseases and also facilitates the body's ability to fight and heal from those diseases. The minimum amount that black people need, because of the fact that we live in a temperate environment rather than a warm tropical environment, is 5,000 IUs or international units per day. If you're not getting that, then you are severely vitamin D3 deficient and overwhelmingly likely to get some form of aggressive cancer that will probably be fatal. So I just wanted to put that information out there so that, people are aware and hopefully can do something to mitigate that early. The last thing I wanted to discuss was when you brought up Urugu, and you talked about Dr. Wilson discussing white people's feelings of inadequacy towards their lack of skin melanin. Well, on the last show that we did, we also had a discussion, weirdly enough, about Urugu. I went kind of in depth into that on the program. And I brought up a study, Dr. Edward Robinson Jr. He is an educator, a lawyer, and quite a few other things from Philadelphia. And he's the one who actually facilitated the city of Philadelphia making it a law that all students have to have a Black Studies course before they can graduate from high school. Now, he came across a genetic study that was done in the 90s. In the 90s, these white geneticists took samples from across the planet, from the United States, from Europe, the Far East and Asia, and the African continent. There, what they were attempting to do was to find out intelligence based on genetics. So they dealt with primates and they dealt with humans. What they found was that the more genetic series that a particular organism has, the more intelligent that organism is. And they found that mountain gorillas were the most intelligent of all the different types of ape species they had. Then they decided to do the test with humans. So their assumption was naturally that white people would be at the top of the list and black people would be at the bottom of the list. So they go about doing the test. So when they did the test on white people, because they considered Americans to be white, and they also stated that they knew that black people in the United States that came here under the duress of slavery were kidnapped from Western Africa, they had no need to test black Americans. So they tested Europeans, white Americans, Asians, and then Africans from the continent. What they found was that Europeans had only 6 genetic series. Asians and every other group that was non-African only had 6 genetic series. Black people had 9. So what they found was the most intelligent from a genetic standpoint being on the planet is the black man and woman. And they immediately sought to suppress that information. So they know us better than we know us. And they actually made it crystal clear. They said, well, because we know that Africans in the Western Hemisphere that came here via slavery, the enslavement process, ultimately came from West Africa, they also have the same 9 genetic series, which is 3 above everyone else who is non-African. And what they found was that the Africans who left Africa to people the rest of the planet basically left early. So they weren't completely fully developed. So they only had the 6 genetic series when they left to people the planet, and their descendants, other non-black people, basically received these genetics that did not complete development. Those Africans that stayed on the continent the longest developed their full genetic expression in the form of these 9 genetic series, which from a genetic standpoint would make us the most intelligent beings on the planet. But because of the system of white supremacy, we've been suppressed and been retarded by the system to the point where they have us in the position that they were in Europe just after the Moors had helped them survive after the plague took out 2/3 of their population. So So again, I just wanted to put that out there. They knew this stuff since the 90s. They hid it from us on purpose. We have the intelligence to figure out how to solve this problem. We just have to come to a consensus on what the problem is and not practice ideological tribalism. That's what I think is one of the major problems of us in the Western Hemisphere, and specifically in America. We practice ideological tribalism.
30 seconds.
Okay, I'll take it real quickly. Ultimately, we have to get out of the practice of, if someone does not believe in the ideology, religion, whatever position I take on a certain subject, that they're the enemy or the outsider. We have to look past that and towards the fact that we have the same problem and need to come up with a solution. With that, I'll mute my line. Thank you very much, Doug.
Much obliged, Roz. A lot of times it won't just be they'll be an outsider or an enemy. They'll be a coon, candidate for coon of the year, in fact. Folks that we've not heard from at all, if you have commentary, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Go ahead, retired firefighter.
Thank you, sir. Greetings, Gus, and everybody else. Greetings to everybody else. On assignment, Mr. Neely Fuller's compensatory counter-racist codified word guide, honorary white person. Do not use this term. When others use it, ask for a detailed explanation that you can easily understand. Also, ask them to explain what it does not mean. Notes. According to a compensatory counter-racist logic, and during the existence of white supremacy racism, there is no such person as an honorary white person. In racial matters, there exists only three classifications of people in the known universe: white, non-white, and white supremacists, racist man and racist woman. The non-white classification includes all shades of black people: brown, tan, yellow, red. The white classification includes all white people. The white supremacist racist classification includes all white people who are not only white, but who also practice white supremacy racism, which is the mistreatment and the non-just subjugation of non-white people by white people based on the color of people. So-called honorary white people are, in truth, those non-white people who are chosen by the white supremacists, racist man and or racist woman, to provide special services to the system of white supremacy racism in return for special material and or praiseworthy benefits. And he has, last but not least, a slave does not stop being a slave because he or she sometimes rides the same horse as the master. And that's Mr. Fuller's understanding of the word honorary white person. Going to my notes, Doug Williams, Mr. Doug Williams. That's the same Mr. Williams who was the first black male to lead a National Football League team to a Super Bowl victory, to a Super Bowl, and also become victorious. He, outside of playing professional football, became a football coach on the collegiate level, and in turn, presently now, he is a part of the administrative staff of the team that is called the Washington Redskins. I think he's in player personnel. He recently was asked something about a black male that the Washington Redskins just recently hired that was involved into a quote-unquote domestic
violent act, allegedly with a female. And he made the comment, small potatoes. As far as that concerned, that was just recently in the news. Basically, I think the small potatoes comment was somehow equating what took place with this particular hiree was small in capacity to incidents primarily that were initiated by white males. In the recent times, I would just say VGQ to it. I probably would have taken another position myself personally by putting the responsibility of hiring anybody where it is due with the owners and the people who have a more powerful position with the team that's called the Washington Redskins than I do within the department that's called player personnel. Moving on. Dante Wilde, if anybody wanted to know who that is, he's the present quote-unquote heavyweight champion of the world. I thought one of his recent comments was interesting, basically on the subject of whether or not black people, quote unquote, love each other. I think Gus plays a remnant of him having a conversation with Mr. Fuller that has a similar insight that Mr. Wilder was expressing just recently. All you have to do is put in the search engine on YouTube, Dante Wilder. And you would get in full content on what he was talking about as far as black people do not love one another. I noticed, I don't know if anybody else has been noticing, during this so-called holiday season, the excelled number of black people who are in commercials. The only way I can factor it in, it's because white people who are the experts in a lot of fields understands that during this time of year, percentage-wise, that non-white people who are racially classified as black probably spend the most money during this time of year. As far as I think it's called consumers during this time of year. So basically, I guess, you know, from that standpoint. From that standpoint, they have that that push with us on television and commercials a lot. And that'll be it. Thank you. I had a lot more, but that's it. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. Let's see. The caller 9029. Thank you for yielding. Did you want to share, sir?
Yes, sir. Greetings to the callers, greetings to the listeners, and peace, Gus. Thank you again for the platform. Retired firefighter got to the information before I did. Peace and blessings on that. But to jump into this, I really want to get into quick is the athlete, unfortunately, that is now suspended and fired. I wish the best for him. Hopefully everything pans out right. I was an athlete myself in college, and we had an incident where one of my teammates, I wasn't there at the time, he explained the story where he was at a diner late at night after being out, and another person approached him and asked him, "Can you assist me real quick? My friend is having a problem." And it turned out that the friend he was with was black, and there were a bunch of other white males calling him a nigger and telling him, you know, go eat watermelon or something of the sort. So my teammate at the time, big guy, 6'6", just walked over and he tried his best to kind of deal with the situation without using his hands, but unfortunately it did turn into that. He ended up, police were called, he was arrested and brought in, and he was detained for some time. But during the time that he was detained, there was another black male in prison in the cell with him who had another incident, who had been with a white woman, also an athlete, and this was in a state that's predominantly white, by the way, also an athlete, and he basically did not want to be with her anymore, said it's off. And my teammate told me that the girl went back to the state trooper and reported that he had raped her. And here he was in the cell with him, and they're both sitting down having this conversation. So when I hear something like this happening to this gentleman, it makes me cringe, because you can only imagine how many other times this happens without us even hearing about it. This is a quote-unquote so-called famous non-black male. Imagine about the other ones that are not even on his level that this happens to on such a regular basis, henceforth making, again, white women some of the most dangerous, if not the most dangerous, race soldier of them all. But I would like to say this, and this will probably close it, is that as something positive, as I recently, I still do my yoga. I tip my hat to you, Gus, and as well my girlfriend. She was really instrumental in pushing me in that direction, and it balances me out along with the other physical activities that I do. And the other physical activity I do is I still play basketball, and after I finish playing, my knees don't hurt. My shoulder doesn't hurt. I'm not limping around after I finish playing. And one of the other things that I will say that's another positive is that this tournament that I play in Brooklyn here, it's a lot of non-white males, mainly predominantly black. There may be two so-called Hispanic men there, but no fights, no fussing, no arguing, no fist throwing, just a clear enjoyment, and everybody there just to compete and to have a couple of jokes and have a good time. I like to just put that out as a good thought and as a good thing, and that's something that we need to do more often when we all are around each other whenever it's most possible. I know that under the system of racism, white supremacy, this may not happen that frequently, but I'm happy that it does happen in this venue that I'm currently in. That being said, all the best to everyone, and I will meet my line. Peace.
Much obliged. Cows Yoga Retreat, February 2010. Cows Yoga Retreat, February 2010. Others we've not heard from at all. If you have a hand up, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Thomas in New York.
Gus, I got your back. How are you? had a hellish day with my terrorizer on my day off. Just terrible. Redskins logo was de-trademarked. A couple years ago, they de-trademarked it, so that way the NFL and the Redskins couldn't make money off of that logo. In January, a judge ruled that had to be taken away. And Nike just re-enhanced their logo on the new jerseys that they made for them. So it's there to stay. Rest in peace to the racist white supremacist George Herbert Walker Bush. I call him Bush One. Son of a Nazi, Prescott Bush, named after his mother's father, Nazi George Herbert Walker Bush, and all that can be confirmed. Yeah. Union Bank was seized under the Trading with the Enemies Act for funding Hitler. Prescott went on to become a senator after that, however. You know, Herbert Walker went on to run the bank with the largest amount of assets on Wall Street, called Brown Brother Harry. These are the most powerful white people and amongst the most richest. And as the highest office of the land, he ordered the DEA to illegally entrap a 19-year-old named Keith Jackson in a park a few blocks away from the White House so he could use it as a anti-crime campaign or anti-drug campaign. This brother did 10 years in jail for that PR stunt. And let's not forget Willie Horton. And they talk about Trump. Should have been calling presidents racist on the news. In Minneapolis, they put up a Christmas tree in the precinct, decorated it with Newport cigarettes, Steel Reserve malt liquor bottles, police tape, a bag of tiki hot, you know, fries, and Louisiana Popeye kitchen chicken boxes and things like that. So they suspended some cops. They don't got Redskins in Minnesota, Gus. They got Vikings. I was watching a Dr. Khalid Muhammad interview. I don't know how this popped up on my YouTube feed, but it's said Dr. Khalid Muhammad and Sean Hannity. So I said, oh, man. So I didn't even know Hannity was around back then, but this was in, like, Huntsville. I think it was Alabama. And, of course, Hannity was antagonizing him, and he called him a devil. Now, Hannity made, it's a point to this, Gus. Hannity made references several times to his huge black bodyguards and how, even commented one time how disciplined they are. So during the break, when they came back, Dr. Khalid Muhammad commented that a white man walked into the studio during this interview, said, I just wanted to look into the eyes of the black man on the radio that I hear talking what he's saying. And then he walked out. He had his gun with him, of course, right through all his big black Fruit of Islam bodyguards. I don't think white people are afraid of black people. The federal government refused to fund states that have private segregation with public money, with white public schools, of course. But what got me was they said that the schools were started being funded by the Northerners. They even were taking up collection plates at churches. I could just see that. When I grew up, they called it the depleted ozone layer. And today they call it global warming. You know, what was called eugenics is today called the Human Genome Project. Eugenics means good genes, good origins, good birth, et cetera. Good means white, as we know. Same funders that funded the perfection of eugenics here in the U.S., so perfect that Hitler copied it, they went through the works of funding Charles B. Davenport. They created what's known as what's known as scientific racism. However, the same people funded him, the Carnegie Institution, the Rockefeller Foundation, of Harriman Family Trust, that's the Bush family, the Kellogg Race Betterment Foundation, and the founder of the Human Genome Project is a student of his, Mr. Watson. That's all I really wanted to say. The last thing, I saw a lot of people writing reports like the Andaman Islanders, who killed this white person who was going there to try to missionize them. And they're making it seem like if white people really didn't want to get on the island, they couldn't. I just think it sounds crazy. I mute my line. Thank you, Gus.
Much obliged, Thomas, in New York. Incidentally, I think Princess asked about this last week. I am not certain that the individual who went on the island and is reportedly dead, was maybe killed, I'm not sure that that was someone classified as white. I looked at his name and I looked at some photographs. That might be a non-white person. Not sure. Definitely not classified as black, I don't think. Others we've not heard from at all. If you have commentary, line should be open. Proceed.
Oh, yes. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I like that. Yeah, I was looking at the, I guess, the NFL clips, and that just shows you how racist the NFL truly is. Because I remember, I think it was last week, there was a black football player. I find it interesting how they talk about Kareem Hunt when last week there was another black football player who played for the 49ers. And they were playing, I think, Tampa Bay. And one of the football players from the 49ers, he beat up his girlfriend. And they showed her picture, and she was a black female. And then after he beat up his girlfriend, who's classified as black, 2 days later, the Washington Redskins said, oh, no problem. They gave him a job. They picked him up and let him play for them. If you look at the one with Kareem Hunt, the lady that he beat up was white. Now, had that woman in that other case for the 49ers, had his girlfriend would have been white, the Washington Redskins wouldn't have picked him up. That goes to show me what happened with the case with Kareem Hunt. And what black people have to understand under racism, white supremacy, even if there was audio, and see, white people are not going to give black people a free pass, even if a white person calls you a nigger and that black person beats that white person up, or they still going to file charges against you and let you go. You know, there's nothing, you're not safe under racism, white supremacy. And also, too, I always ask black people, and I think I heard this on your show a long time ago, is that, and I tell black people this, don't give white people the power to control your emotions. You know, when they call you a nigger, they just want to get you upset. And I ask black people, if a white person calls you a nigger, ask yourself, what does that word mean? Define that word, and then why is it that you want to beat up that white person? What makes you so enraged that you want to beat up that white person? I said, don't play into their game. And, you know, and the last thing I want to say is, and like I said, to show you how racist the NFL is, you have Colin Kaepernick, who hadn't hit anybody. He just played good football, and he protested. He still can't find a job as a quarterback in the NFL. That's all I had. I'll mute my line.
Much obliged, sir. Others we've not heard from at all. If you have commentary, proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, everyone. This is Ms. Tien. In the clip, they were discussing about President Trump, how he said that he was slowing down the melting pot. Me and my daughter, we had a discussion about the melting pot. And, you know, when something melts together, you think that it's blended together and you can't determine the origin of what it originally was. And we were discussing that. And we said that the melting pot is for when white people move to America, they're considered white and everybody else is considered African-American, Asian-American, or whatever area they allege that that person came from. And also in the clips, it talks about the young kids staying at home. Like I said, my daughter, she's in college. She's staying at home with us right now. And I told her we're giving her the opportunity to stay at home, to get her education. To work is an option, so she has the choice of to work or not to work. And I told her she needs to go out, you know, when she's on breaks like summer or wherever these little breaks they have, to get a job, because she needs to get the experience of dealing with people and coping and learning how to deal with people, because when she gets out in the real world, she's going to have to learn how to deal with people. And the same people that she deals with at these jobs that she may get during summer or whenever are going to be the same people she's going to be dealing with when she gets out there and get a real job. And also, it's the season for the holidays, and we're having a holiday party at work this coming Thursday. And the owner of the company said that hopefully the party is going to be a lot of fun. And when I think of that word fun, I think of Neely Fuller definition of the reason why white people practice racism, white supremacy, is for fun, glory, and materialistic gain. Thank you.
Absolutely. Much obliged, Miss Tien. Is there going to be alcohol at the party? Do you know, at the shindig? Do you know?
Well, I just started this job, so this is going to be my first party with them, so I'm not sure, but given the fact that they're white, most likely.
Sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism, especially at the office shindigs. Other folks that we have missed completely, if you have a hand up, proceed.
May I be heard?
Greetings, Red in Nevada.
I'll make it quick. I thought it was interesting with the clip about the quote-unquote Native American or Indigenous Americans, who American females who go missing and being underreported or not reported. And just it kind of seems, and like how they use the term or how they said, the police in some area, I forgot where, they would just default to white. But then I also, you know, was thinking about how there are some quote unquote people who are considered or classified as Native American, but who are white, who were only classified as Native American because of the Dawes rolls. So I thought that that was interesting. There was one other thing. I actually can't think of it right now. I'll just leave it at that. Thank you, and I'll mute my line.
I am sure your thought will come back to you before we conclude in 15 minutes. I will check back in. Others that we missed completely.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Victim in Austin, Texas. Making a quick call from the plantation. I wasn't able to hear any of the stories beforehand, any of the news clips, so I apologize. But I believe that you guys were discussing gene editing and CRISPR technology and whatnot. And I just had a quick comment on that. I believe that that this will probably not end well for non-whites, even though apparently it was a non-white male who had managed to successfully edit, you know, some embryos or whatnot and create these children without some kinds of defects. As long as white supremacists are in charge, it will definitely not work well for us. And I think that it was Stephen Hawking who talked about his fear of there being a superhuman race being created using this kind of technology, and he basically said that humans who are unaltered or unedited or whatnot will become obsolete or unimportant. So it is something to be concerned about. I think that's all that I had on that. But finally, regarding the yoga retreat, can you confirm the location and the dates that will occur? And that's all I have for you guys and listeners. Thank you.
The details will be forthcoming. I know for certain February, I was looking at two dates. I know it definitely will not be on the actual day of our anniversary, which is the 21st, because that's kind of in the middle of the week. And I don't think that would be best for anybody's schedule. But yes, all of that will be confirmed within the next few days or so. I'll be able to share. And yep, but we will be doing the yoga retreat February 2010. Yoga is grand. Others that we missed completely, we've not heard from you at all, and you have a hand up, proceed.
Can I be heard?
I knew it. I knew it.
I know I've, this actually goes with workplace racism. I know I've kind of been having issues with, like lots of jokes, and I don't want to say taunting. I know like tacky behavior received that I get from terrorists about even, you know, trying to eat better and like my journey with veganism. And then like they'll kind of like the suspected races, they'll kind of involve like the Black people around me. So I thought that that was, you know, interesting. And also kind of trying to talk me out of it, or kind of talk about the benefits of eating pork or, you know, some meat. It can help you absorb different vitamins better. And I was thinking about actually what when Roz was talking, how even my doctor, he also is another suspected racist. He was saying that I'm vitamin D insufficient or whatever, or deficient, and just said that I should take vitamin D capsules, and actually the exact same amount, the 5,000, I think it's UI or something like that. And I was telling him I was taking them, you know, every day. And he was like, no, that's too much. So I thought that that was interesting. Even, you know, being in Nevada where there's so much daylight, it's still not enough. And then, of course, there's also the chemtrails. And I'll meet my line. Thank you.
Much obliged. Red in Nevada. I think a lot of that is your skin actually exposed. A lot of times people are really covered up outside. So your skin is actually not even getting contact with the sun at all. Others that we've not heard from at all, if you have commentary, proceed. Did we nab everybody? Anybody that we missed completely?
Can I be heard?
Greetings, caller in Florida.
Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners, and callers. I wanted to start off by the segment about the, I think they were saying, the non-white indigenous or Native American female that was speaking about how, I guess, what goes underreported as far as the racial classifications, and she was being emphatic about them applying that information. And it was fascinating how they were saying that it was left up to the, I guess, the race soldiers to apply what they thought the person was, either white or non-white. It sounded like that's what they were trying to say, and it would just default as white if they don't apply a classification. So, you know, I was thinking about how they deeply exploit different segments of non-white victims and classify them as white. Then in actuality, it looks as though they treat them as non-white. And it looks like for these statistics and these research situations that they bring about, they will classify them as white. From what I've been noticing myself, and it's just another form of mistreatment. And I've been trying to think of a concept and a term, but I hadn't fully developed it yet. But when I hear that, and then I hear like all the way in Australia, how the non-white person was called nigger rat, and they were trying to, as Gus described it, they were doing those practicing codification, seemed like they were trying to call him by his real name, I guess, and then calling him nigger rat. So just definitely racist exploitation there. And for the football player who got in that confrontation, I did see that clip on the news, and they described it as racial slur. Like, I can't just be explicit and say what it was. And I automatically concluded that he was called a nigger or some kind of derivative. And they used the term designer babies in the same broadcast, and they contrasted it, or they showed it after that segment. So I thought that was interesting. And that's all I have for this weekend. Thanks for allowing me to share.
That is interesting. Contrast programming, the savage bull rushing black male and then designer babies. Any other folks that we missed completely? We got everyone. Spectacular. Let's see. Retired firefighter said he had several other things to say. Oh, wait a minute. The caller is 6361. Did you already share? Did we get you?
Yes, I'm just going to wait.
Oh, okay. Wonderful. Retired firefighter, I guess 30 seconds. Did you have something you wanted to share? You said, or not 30 seconds. We'll say 60 seconds. Did you have more you wanted to share?
Yes, I can. I'm in the process of putting another roof on the residence that I'm allowed to stay in. And so I've been interviewing a few potential roofers. This particular person showed up to the residence, a white male, and he was, you know, we were discussing about a roof, and somewhere in the conversation, he stated that he would be as honest as he could. And I don't know if anybody else thinks in the same way that I thought, that right there placed in my mind the comment, you know, to make the statement as honest as he could. And I did express my concern about that statement to him. Also, he kept using the word fair. And I also mentioned that to him, and to, you know, from the standpoint of him saying something that describes correctness and also associated with people who call themselves white at the same time is something incorrect about the use of the word. That was an experience that took place a couple of days ago. And last but not least, Mr. Elbert, better known as Big Man with the Black Panther Party. I think he was the same person that Bobby Hutton came to get a weapon from when him and Mr. Cleaver, Eldridge Cleaver, were in this gun battle with Oakland police. He was in deep regret about giving that firearm to 16-year-old Bobby Hutton, because in turn what took place, as most of us know, that he was murdered by the police in that confrontation back in, I think it was the day after the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King was murdered, that incident took place. And that is it. Thank you, Gus, for allowing me to voice again. Thank you.
Indeed. 30 seconds. Anybody have a final comment they can share in 30 seconds or less?
Hey, can I? Yes, no, go ahead.
This is Ken Steele. I just wanted to say, hit me up if you want a link to the fight. I got it in stunning HD. Thanks.
Reading is more important than watching television. The other caller, 20 seconds.
Hey, how you doing? I just wanted to add, too. I got a chance to, while I was listening to you guys, I looked at the video. And the football player, when he put the white woman out the room, it just made me, and how she was consistent on entering the room. It just made me think of the man knot, and how black men turning down white women advances to be a situation of life or death. That was just interesting. That's all. Just referring to the man knot.
Dr. Tommy J. Curry, the man not race, class, genre, and the dilemmas of black manhood. That is this Thursday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We are looking forward to it. And Willie Horton, to get the update to include George H.W. in our commentary on the man knot. Willie Horton. Whew, that will do it for this broadcast. I hope it was a constructive investment of your Saturday evening. Much obliged to all of the folks who participated. Thanks so much for your commentary, counter-racist views. You can drop an email if you have questions, gripes, guest suggestions, details about the Cows Yoga Retreat, untiljustice@gmail.com. Reading is more important than watching television. With that, sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism, especially if you find yourself at an office party. Oh, man. Extra sober. You are drinking bottled water. That's about the strongest drink that you are going to have in your hand for the 30 minutes that you are present. But sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. When we are in a vehicle, sober and buckled up, driver or passenger, let's do all we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.